Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, February 26th, 2026. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Daniel Bogoslaw will be with us to talk about his investigation into Bohemian Grove. And later in the show, Ashiq Sadiq and Megan Romer, co-chairs of DSA, will be joining us to talk about DSA hitting a major membership milestone. Also on the program, Trump continues to give Lindsey Graham the bluest of balls. Sorry for that image. Toying. I'm testing to see if you guys are paying attention.
I wasn't.
Yeah, no. Snapping it. Focus.
Pay attention, you two. Because he's toying with bombing Iran, but also still trying to do peace talks in Geneva. And Lindsay's like, just give me this release, please. I don't have it in a lot of other areas. Anyway, we move on. Some of Trump's advisors want Israel to strike Iran instead of the U.S. to avoid the bad optics. But yeah, Israel's totally sovereign, not our colony at all. Don't worry about it. By the way, this is predicated on the White House saying Iran's just so close to getting a nuke after claiming they obliterated said nuclear program last year. Cuba's border patrol shot at a speedboat from the U.S., one nautical mile from its coast, killing four and saying they seized weapons from said boat. Not seeing a ton of denial from the U.S. Interesting. Trump tells Zelensky that he wants a peace deal by summer, the first time they've spoken in around a month. Thune throws cold water on Trump's push to nuke the filibuster to pass the mass disenfranchisement bill, SAVE Act. A blind refugee from Burma has been found dead after Border Patrol dropped him at a donut shop 5 miles from his home. The White House's war on Minnesota continues. Vance announces they're pausing Medicaid funding over the Somali daycare conspiracy. A top Treasury official has resigned after privately raising objections to this attack on Minnesota. FEC filings reveal that House Democrats' fundraising arm has taken millions from Palantir lobbyists. And lastly, trans people in Kansas are reporting receiving letters from the state demanding they surrender their driver's licenses. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It's a Majority Report Thursday. Hello, Matt. Hello, Brian. Who needs coffee when I can provide you with shocking graphic imagery like that? Ad hominem writes in, Jesus, we're like 30 seconds into the show and I want to gouge out my eyes. Thanks for the mental image. You're welcome. That's what I'm here for. I'm in a good mood because we were social last night, specifically myself and Matt, although we said that and spent 90% of the time just talking to each other.
We did talk to other people too.
We did talk to other people and it was lovely. It was lovely to meet everybody last night. I was really honored to be like the moderator for David Griscom's book talk. I read the whole book, The Myth of Red Texas. It's great. People should check it out, pick it up. OR Books is publishing it with The Nation. And I think that there's a live stream that our channel should have shared where if you want to watch the book talk from last night, you can. So it was really, really cool to be a part of that. Everybody check out The Myth of Red Texas by David Griscom. And it was a full house. It was fun. It was a fun time. Let's turn back to Minnesota here, because, you know, after terrorizing the Twin Cities, killing two American citizens in Minnesota, beating and pepper spraying countless more, destroying property, kidnapping countless people, shutting down schools, causing car accidents, the White House has decided that their war on Minnesota has not been cruel enough. During the State of the Union, Trump talked about waging a war on fraud, and he's now tasking J.D. Vance with it. The trope that black people and immigrants are stealing our social services is, in conservative politics, is nothing new. They just recycle it, and they'll have rotating groups that they're looking at. But
it was welfare queens.
The welfare queen. Yeah.
In the 80s.
This is a fishing expedition based on racist tropes that go back decades and decades. The welfare queen one, as Matt mentions, is the most infamous. So, yeah, Vance had this press conference yesterday, and he was joined by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services admin, Dr. Oz.
Scam doctor.
And they're announcing here that they're going to pause Medicaid, federal Medicaid reimbursements to Minnesota over this fraud conspiracy that we'll talk about in just a second.
Which has been prosecuted under the Biden administration, like, and they didn't find anything new to go after. So that's why they're all of a sudden doing sanctions now, because there was actually no new fraud they uncovered.
Right. Here is the Vice President, J.D. Vance, announcing this halt.
So we're announcing today that we have decided to temporarily halt certain amounts of Medicaid funding that are going to the state of Minnesota in order to ensure that the state of Minnesota takes its obligations seriously to be good stewards of the American people's tax money. Now, what is this going to mean? What this means is
that— Does it mean shovel it to J.D. Vance's friends in the tech sector so they can build data centers? Is that what good steward is? Sorry, I'll let him continue.
People's tax money. Now, what is this going to mean? What this means is that, first of all, the providers on the ground in Minnesota have actually already been paid. The state has paid those providers the money. What we're doing is we are stopping the federal payments that will go to the state government until the state government takes its obligations seriously to stop the fraud that's being perpetrated against the American tax. So we're announcing today.
Well, actually, play that part for a second. The first 4 seconds where he goes, so we're announcing today. I mean, like, he's so bitchy and unpresidential. Just this.
So we're announcing today that we have decided
I mean, literally, it reminds me of, like, sorority meetings. Like, so we're announcing today that we're wearing animal print at the Deke party. Anyway. He's just so whiny. It's so annoying. But we're going to get to the fraud in a second here. This is incredibly cruel. They've already, this administration, taken a hatchet to Medicaid with the one big ugly ass bill. And prior to its passage, around 70 million people in this country rely on Medicaid. Lower income people, people with disabilities, CHIP is the one for children. That is incredibly important for child for low-income families as well. So this is going to apparently impact in Minnesota nearly 1.3 million people, one in four Minnesotans, if they're able to pause these federal Medicaid reimbursements. And Medicaid costs are shared by states and by the federal government. The states, Minnesota and the other states do this as well, pay the cost to administer the program, and then you have the federal government and this reimbursement system. This could really undercut the, like, severely undercut the ability to provide health care for people. as
blowing up rural hospitals.
Right. As they give this like vague target of until they kind of get their house in order, until Minnesota figures out what's going on. And the reality is that there's nothing there. Let's just pull up this article here from the Minnesota Post. One, Minnesota is one of the many blue states that is a donor state, meaning its federal tax contribution exceeds the amount it receives in federal funding. The federal government collected about $119 billion in tax revenue from Minnesota residents and businesses in 2023. The state, in return, received about $75 billion to support health care, nutrition, Social Security, and other programs, according to USA Facts, a not-for-profit organization that analyzes government data. That $44 billion difference between taxes and revenue equated to about $7,600 per Minnesotan. And among 19 donor states in 2023, Delaware was the only one where residents had a higher net cost than Minnesotans. So this is also just like not true on its face.
Like even if Minnesota was a donor state, there could still be fraud. But the whole thing about fraud is a complete Klan type lie. Just like everything this administration does, they did tariffs accusing Canada of trafficking fentanyl into our country. It was like just a complete lie that like certain people like to take seriously. And there's a type of thinking that is like, no, you can't just dismiss this Somali fraud stuff because it makes you look bad. No, actually, it's people like you that shouldn't give these liars a goddamn inch, because it was prosecuted under Biden. People are looking into it. The idea that we let this stuff run rampant is, again, a Klan fantasy or a Klan propaganda point.
Yes, and so it started in 2019. There was an investigation into fraud at child care centers. The estimate was like $5 to $6 million in total. And when we're looking at the figures that we're speaking about, that is not a large amount. Charges were filed. The state tightened regulations. Then there was the prosecution under Biden. But they're reviving this in 2025 and 2026 to justify their attacks on Minnesota, their attacks on the Somali community, motivated by a far-right agenda in the White House that hates Somali Americans, one, because they have incredibly high citizenship rates compared to other groups. So the fact that they're here so legally is a threat to their agenda of ethnic cleansing. And also, they are Black, and also, they are Muslim. So these are all factors into why this administration is targeting them.
And Minnesota, in large, with exceptions, has been welcoming of them. And like Ilhan Omar, people act like she's a member of a majority Somali district. She's not. Her district is majority white. That's what drives them crazy.
I've cited this channel. We've cited it many, many times. I think I did the other day, speaking about Jose's Tucker Carlson segment, where it's behind. I'm a patron, so I've been able to access it, but I'd encourage other people, if they like these kinds of investigative video essay deep dives into political issues, to do the same if you want to see that Tucker one, because it was really great. But this was from around a month ago, a great debunking of this Nick Shirley video that kicked all of this off, these claims of Somali daycare fraud. And here is Jose's breakdown of that piece and how it's being mischaracterized, specifically in 2025, when there was those instances that we've already spoken about, but it's being distorted and they're trying to retrofit it into this 2025 daycare context.
The other claim of $100 million in CCAP fraud a year isn't quite so clear-cut. On the most basic level, the figure seems to be inflated. Over the course of several years, prosecution of fraud amounted to somewhere between $5 and $6 million, a far cry from the $100 million a year that was being cited. However, the actual amount of fraud is difficult to determine, and this report declined to make an actual estimate of how much fraud is happening in the state when it comes to CCAP funding. At least one CCAP fraud investigator believed the $100 million figure could be accurate, but unlike what the Nick Shirley video alleges, it's not about daycares sitting empty all day, but rather daycares not providing adequate service, like adults spending more time chatting amongst themselves or on their phones rather than watching the children. Representatives from the Department of Human Services more strongly disagreed with the $100 million figure because prior investigations didn't turn up anywhere near that amount. While there was certainly some amount of fraud that was unaccounted for, the $100 million figure seemed unrealistic. And when looking at the total budget of the CCAP service, it would account to more than a third of all funds allocated. In spite of the findings in this report, particularly the lack of evidence connecting fraud to funding terrorism, this talking point continued to lumber on. Here's an example from a local radio show on WZFG talking about it.
Dude, it goes back pre-COVID. The daycare one was 2017. Yeah, was that's it? $250 million.
I don't know how it suddenly became $250 million, but that's the interesting thing about these fraud cases. Once they're discussed in the media, the figures start getting inflated, and the type of fraud that may or may not be happening is frequently exaggerated. In May of 2025, there was another report that looked specifically at attendance records at...
No, this is the part I want to play, yeah. It's really good. The whole thing's an hour. People should really check it out. We'll link to it.
In May of 2025, there was another report that looked specifically at attendance records at child care assistance providers that raised some interesting questions. A news article from MinnPost covering the report said, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services Office of the Inspector General sampled 1,155 child care centers and found that 11% of the payments made to those centers in 2023 had errors. But that doesn't necessarily mean there was fraud. Improper payments is an umbrella term that could include fraud. An 11% rate puts Minnesota above the permissible 10% threshold established by the federal government, UN said. On average, nationwide, the rate is 4%. So while child care fraud is something Minnesota has been working to reduce in recent years, these are not new issues, but they are being repackaged and they are being promoted in ways to make it seem like there is an epidemic, said Elliot Haspel, a national child care expert, on a call with reporters this week.
So there you go. This is the, again, check out that Jose video on Nick Shirley. It's entitled Minnesota, Nick Shirley and the Demonizing of a Community. There's more there. But that's the key point with that background, which is that they're using this term of improper payments, which includes basically a wide variety of violations, they don't have the proper health codes here, or they don't have enough staffing, or the staff was on their phone and that kind of thing, and not paying proper attention to the children and stuff. They're claiming that all of that stuff is fraud when a lot of it is just like violations. So they're trying to tie in that older investigation into this more modern one as a way to justify an ethnic cleansing campaign targeted at Minnesota.
Yep, it's a Jim Crowite Klansman lie. That's what J.D. Vance is. He's the same person who's repeating the lie that there's 20 to 30 million illegal immigrants in this country. Complete lie. Completely like a double or triple what the actual case is. And if you look at those, that the 10 million or so, 12 million or so, 40% are people who overstayed visas. Like, this is all lies. It's entirely based on lies. And there's no halfway between this. The people that are now saying, well, I supported, deportations, but not like this. They're the same suckers.
Exactly right. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Daniel Bogoslaw. But first, a word from our sponsor today. Long work weeks and busy weekends can leave you feeling and looking depleted. Prolon's 5-day fasting mimicking diet works at a cellular level to reset and rejuvenate you from the inside out, supporting sustained fat loss, lean muscle, metabolism, slower aging, and even glowing skin. And I can say this as somebody who was a little nervous when Sam said that he was going to be trying fasting. I didn't know if he might be a little cranky. I didn't know if it might be a little difficult. But I noticed his energy levels were up. And he just couldn't believe it. He was like, I can't believe it. It's really working for me. And that was when basically we decided Prolon was going to be a great sponsor for our show. Prolon is a plant-based nutrition program featuring soups, snacks, and beverages designed to nourish the body while keeping it in a fasting state, triggering cellular rejuvenation and renewal. Developed over decades with USC's Longevity Institute and backed by top U.S. medical centers, Prolon has been shown to support biological age reduction, metabolic health, skin appearance, fat loss with muscle protection, energy, and a healthier relationship with food. With Prolon, you get everything you need in prepackaged, it's all prepackaged and ready to go. Each order of Prolon's 5-day program comes with 5 boxes labeled by day so you know exactly what to eat. No prep or planning required. And when you want to reset and you want to have your body kind of get into that fasting mode, it's really helpful to have it just laid out for you. No prep needed. You don't need to plan. You got your boxes. You're set to go. And you have kind of a goal and markers that you can meet as you're resetting. If you're ready for your own reset, for a limited time, Prolon is offering the Majority Report audience 15% off site-wide plus a $40 bonus gift when you subscribe to their 5-day program. Just visit prolonlife.com/majority. That's prolonlife.com/majority to claim your 15% discount and your bonus gift. prolonlife.com/majority, link down below in the video and episode descriptions, and at majority.fm. Get 15% off plus a $40 bonus gift when you subscribe to their 5-day program at prolonlife.com/majority. Quick break. When we're back, we'll be joined by Daniel Bogoslaw. We are back, and we are joined now by Daniel Bogoslaw, investigative journalist covering corporate crime, government agencies, and politics at Deeper States on Substack. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I'm excited to talk to you about this because as we're dealing with and you know, just trying to understand the Epstein files and the real formality of this kind of elite network, I think it has people looking at other elite networks and secret societies like the one at Bohemian Grove with a different kind of perspective. And so I wonder if you could just speak a little bit about that, you know, how this new climate of understanding elite networks maybe even informed your reporting on Bohemian Grove.
Absolutely. Well, it was exciting to publish the list this week of the Bohemian Club and Grove's membership list with the fine folks at More Perfect Union. I, you know, sort of developed an obsession with the Grove many years ago. And when the COVID vaccines finally rolled out, I took my COVID bucks and I headed out and tried to chase down that story and a bunch of other ones. But before I did that, one of the sort of foundational American sociologists named Bill Domhoff sort of wrote the foundational text, one of the foundational texts of American sociology called The Power Elite, and really used the Bohemian Club as his focus to show that this was not a so much a singular cabal that was running the world and running America, but it was a window into the power elite, and it was a window into the people who were making a lot of the decisions. And you know, whether it's the Bohemian Grove and the Bohemian Club or whether it's Jeffrey Epstein's network, I think it is important to realize that this is a singular window into a very large community of one percenters, and no single window is going to explain everything, right? There's a million Fortune 500 companies. There's a million CEOs. There's a million corrupt officials inside and outside of government. But these instances of pulling the curtain back give us a view into how these relationship networks work, and they serve as a moment for public debate where we can then discuss, okay, how do we use the tools at our disposal, whether it's the laws of our land, whether it's politics, to try to disrupt some of those networks and try to disrupt the stranglehold that these people and companies have on our country and on our democracy.
I wanted to play this part of in 2000, this old clip of Alex Jones infiltrating Bohemian Grove. And Brian was laughing about this.
It's very formative for me as a child.
I honestly was not familiar, when we're talking about Epstein, that was another conspiracy that that Alex Jones was all over until, you know, you make it about just the Democrats. There's questions about whether or not Alex Jones was intercepted by like kind of deep state forces and was participating in limited hangouts, I think.
I mean, this was really what made his career, the Bohemian Grove video. And I would just point out before we play it that, I mean, the focus gets deeper and deeper to this idea of child sacrifice and demon worship. And I think it's dangerous. And you can see certain elements trying to steer the Epstein saga in that direction, too. I think it's critical to understand that, like, the real bottom line of both of these sagas is institutional power and yes. social networks. And so I tried to offer my documentary as somewhat of a corrective to Alex Jones's to say, look, this isn't about demon worship or whatever, Cthulhu. This is about powerful people colluding to shape politics and commerce.
Absolutely. And that is important to emphasize, too, where even the mainstream press on Epstein is focusing on, you know, the salaciousness or the horrible crimes of the pedophilia. Right. But not the like Israeli intelligence connections, for example,
critically, the suspicious activity reports, the bankers who were involved,
yes.
not just the Jamie Dimons, but the second, third, fourth string people who were in these circles. I've just been rewatching Succession with my wife, and it's like, look at how many people touched, you know, the big scandal in that show. We have this from multiple institutions, for the biggest banks in the world, JP Morgan, Deutsche. Ron Wyden still hasn't, you know, gotten the balls to release the full SAR reports, the full records of those banking transactions. And meanwhile, you know, we're getting more and more, as you said, salacious details coming out, more and more records about, honestly, at this point, some fringe allegations, and it's being steered away from the institutions, and it's being steered away from institutional change. And that's what I hope we can kind of drag it back towards.
Yes, I'd like to, we'll have that systemic substantive conversation in a second, but first we want to laugh a little bit about this. So this is Alex Jones in 2000.
Exposing the criminal activities of the global elite, also known as the New World Order. In past films, we've documented the centralization of power, the move towards world government, the attack on the nation state, self-defense, the Second Amendment, family values, that is, the family itself, as well as private property rights. But time and time again in my research, I come, well, eye to eye with something that's even hard for me to believe. And that's that the elite, again, the so-called establishment kings, those that know best, the visions of the anointed ones, are obsessed with the occult, from presidents to governors to the heads of industry. We've all seen the stories of presidents and first ladies obsessed with their astrologers making national policy
decisions.
All right,
we're going to skip ahead like 30 seconds. That's why I was questioning. The in was 140, right? Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was from the very beginning.
Yeah, go to like
2 minutes. 2 minutes in, sorry. Yeah.
100-acre secluded redwood grove. Yeah. Leaders from around the world, prime ministers, chancellors, presidents, governors, again, the heads of industry, banking, academia, the media, Hollywood, only a select few, a little over 2,000 people, travel there to engage in bizarre, ancient, Canaanite, Luciferian, Babylon mystery religion ceremonies. At least that was the rumors. And so I went to the library and got on the internet and saw many of the mainstream news articles admitting that world leaders do indeed go there.
Okay, pause it. Okay. All right, we're sorry about this. We just wanted to get this part go really quickly.
Like fused with ancient druidic rites, where you have the female side of Satan, which they first call out to in the
At Bohemian Grove,
and then towards the horned god with the he, mixed with Masonic rites from Scotland.
Okay, all right. So, just to give people a sense of what the conspiracism was about. Now, Daniel, your reporting revealed the names of the people who were at Bohemian Grove. And by the way, when you were at The Intercept, they tried to kind of kill this story, which is very interesting, and maybe you can talk a little bit about that. But yeah, it seems to me that his fixation on the rituals is obscuring the true conspiracy here, which is that it's like presidents, the Koch brothers, people associated with currently Project 2025, all meeting at this location and determining things like gutting Social Security, for example.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the big ones that we reported on the doc. But there's a lot of Heritage Foundation members who are, you know, half their board, I think, was kind of on our snapshot list that we got. Also, one part that we didn't fully explore in the documentary is the incredible number of military, high-ranking four-stars, military generals, Navy admirals who are on my list, including General Hayes, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs during the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, who kind of put together the War on Terror playbook, and then subsequently went on, of course, to join the boards of multiple defense contractors. So whether it's that sort of macro scale or whether it was looking at the individual encampments where they sort of have these camps within the larger camp, right, where they summer, and showing that members of one of those camps within a camp had donated, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to a Neighbors for a Better San Francisco nonprofit, which opposed, you know, progressive ballot measures and all these things. So, you know, literally disrupting the city that the clubhouse is based in, you know, from the micro to the macro, you can see the hard economic realities of how these people work together. Also, you know, massive donors, you know, a dozen donors to Dave McCormick, the senator from Pennsylvania, who launched his campaign month after the 2023 Grove encampment. So again, this does not show that these people run the entire world, but it shows how they work together to, you know, oppose progressive change or to forward their economic and social interests. And, you know, I think whether it's the Epstein list, whether it's this, you know, there is an outpouring of populist outrage. And the question is, how do we channel that? You know, and I don't think that politicians in Washington, I think they're it's great that they've opened the book, but I don't think that they've done a good job channeling it. And I don't think they've done a good job pulling the right strings thus far.
Absolutely not. So I guess then we can just take us back through the history of Bohemian Grove. How did it start? Even if you could talk about more recent history than its founding, like at its height, really, the Nixonian and Reagan kind of conservative apparatus being very tied to Bohemian Grove.
Sure. So it was actually started as a sort of progressive drinking club for San Francisco's kind of OG Bohemians. Like, we're not talking about like the Beat Generation. We're going even farther back into the 1800s. You know, and people, you know, it attracted a lot of real left-wing progressive forces. Jack London, was, you know, is sort of one of the famous, most famous members of that era. But of course, then it started attracting the barons of industry. I think we see that all the time today. You know, think of something like Burning Man, right? Which kind of started as just kind of freaks, like San Francisco freaks and California freaks going out into the desert, and then was slowly co-opted by rich people who have no generative or creative abilities of their own, mm-hmm. but are hungry, right, for that sort of outlaying of whatever. And then it sort of is slowly transformed decade after decade into this elite networking zone. And there's this, you know, summer enclave, which is supposed to be a retreat from work, right? Their motto is "Weaving spiders come not here." The big Alex Jones style ritual with this effigy that's burned in front of the owl is called the cremation of care. The idea being that you're burning the toil and concern of day to day life, and you're entering into this retreat. But in the mid-century, it does become this really unique summit for the West Coast and eventually the East Coast political elite. You know, the Manhattan, the sort of foundational elements of the Manhattan Project are planned there during the off season. Nixon ends up going there to shore up support and meet people. Reagan is continually going there. Former FBI and CIA directors start going. And then in the early 2000s, you also see this sort of Bush era national security cohort. Colin Powell, Rumsfeld are all members. And we had a former employee tell us that Colin Powell, I think, played Hamlet, or at least was in the production.
It was
of
some
Hamlet.
Shakespearean. I listened to that whole report, and that part made me laugh. Some Shakespearean play that they put on, and there was and Colin Powell starred in it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so childish too, which is like my finish your point, and then I'll make another point.
No. So I'm just saying that it's a good way to show elite collusion, and in a way, we already know this, right? We know that the upper classes work together; they engage in mergers and acquisitions together. But this shows that a granular detail, and I think inspires people to say, like, okay, we have to figure out a way to reduce this level of power. And so there's a literal component of this, right, which is looking and actually tracing the money and looking at campaign finance donations and looking at policy memos that were sent back and forth referencing the Grove. But there's also an emotional element, which is to say these people are partying and getting pissed drunk and literally pissing on these gorgeous, you know, 100-year-old redwoods. And, you know, is that really the world we want to live in, where those are the people determining our national policy?
And when we say people, we should also just make clear men. It's all right. Men. It's right. A men's only club, yes. Right? I mean, that has not changed to this day.
There was one large lawsuit around this issue. And I think, like, eventually they let women come visit, but women are not members. And the other thing I would say, too, is that, like, despite all their power, there have been successful class action lawsuits from Grove workers, from valets, from people who won settlements for accusations of wage theft and discrimination. So it's also, like, as rich and powerful as these guys are, like, they also can't help themselves but be dicks and then have to fork over, you know, millions of dollars to pay out their employees.
Right. How does this differ when I mentioned how childish it is? You know, I how does this differ from, say, other secret societies like Skull and Bones, where we know, you know, if you went to Yale, you're like Bush and what was Kerry in Skull and Bones? I'm forgetting. But, you know, a lot of that's in college, I guess. It's almost like they level up outside of college. And it's like we're going to do the secret society. But now that we're billionaires and top politicians and we have the power to implement whatever we want.
Yeah, I mean, I think those clubs are really interesting. I've always been interested in them, but they're much smaller scale, right? Like, those are just in terms of membership, they are, you know, I think usually it's like, it's only around a dozen, I think, people a year. So you're looking at, you know, maybe 40 people total or something. You know, Harvard has a bunch of them, Porcelain Club, which I think the Winklevoss are in, and I think is in the Social Network. But again, I think going back to Bill Domhoff, the sociologist I mentioned, you know, that these clubs are not essential, right? Like, these people already exist in this amorphous upper class. They have telephones, they have email addresses, they can pick up the phone and call each other. But these places are windows into these associations. So again, they're not essential for the collaboration of this sort of 1%, but they show us, you know, reporters, researchers, they are sort of signposts for how these things work. And I think the same is can be said with Epstein. You know, like, there's a lot of billionaires who are engaging in tax crime and fraud and hush money settlements. And what we got with this Epstein saga is a view, a small view into, you know, one corner of that world.
Talk a little bit about the examples of Bohemian Club members coming together to determine policy. There was a story in the More Perfect Union report about a Reagan advisor being convinced to cut the capital gains tax at the Grove. Other efforts to cut Social Security planned at the Grove. The Koch brothers, part of this club. And, I mean, open it up and talk about some of the worst examples.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the Koch brothers piece is really interesting too, right? They brought Clarence Thomas there to kind of wine and dine him. And, you know, those examples are, you know, there's documentation outside of my list, right? Like, in the presidential libraries, even in the FBI archive, there are examples of the Lakeside talks of the FBI and CIA directors giving speeches there. But I think one of the most interesting things we uncovered in terms of policy was the fact that, you know, Donald Trump, you know, I have two sources that basically say Donald Trump wanted to join the club. He approached the club, and basically the club was like, you're dirty new money. You know, we are old money. And, you know, they very much were kind of the Jeb Bush, you know, neocon faction of the Republican Party. But even after Donald Trump was rejected by them, you know, they still kind of found a way to court his advisors and to, you know, use the Heritage Foundation to sort of craft his playbook and to try to still, you know, negotiate with that side. And they were able to do that because they had a deep donor network and they had deep connections. So I think that is a really interesting example where, you know, we have this documentation of discussion being had of, you know, federal policy being shaped. But then we also see that even when things go wrong for them, even when things go south, they have such a powerful diffuse network that they're kind of able to sneak their tentacles back in and realign things.
Hey, when you mentioned the you're the new money thing, that's a fascinating part of this, too, because I noticed that these members are, I mean, even though the Bushes are fashion themselves as Texans, the reality is they came from old money in the Northeast. And then George H.W. Bush, probably working with intelligence, started an oil company in Texas. And that's where they rebranded. But like when you compare it to the Epstein class, it's almost newer money and more like national security base, perhaps. But I'm trying to draw a distinction here. It seems like very much like this Bohemian Grove formal network at the height of its power, perhaps was like the 70s and 80s. And this was also these kind of blue blooded conservative forces that shape the modern Republican Party, for example.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that, like, in the pre-internet age, right, this type of FaceTime, this type of, you know, kind of roving event, right? I mean, it's this huge, like, it's like 70 acres or something, right, with all these different clubhouses and events and stuff. So I think during that time, it was actually a more important networking space, and that's why you kind of see it even greater hyper concentration. But I think, yeah, I think the defense aspect is really interesting. I mean, there's obviously an intelligence nexus. I mean, there's a former NSA director on the list I have, but I think to me, what's more interesting is the sheer number of military commanders. You know, that's really where you see that these people who, you know, are, you know, I personally am of the opinion that, you know, we have civilian control of the military. You know, I actually think that, like, you know, I obviously think the war in Iraq and Afghanistan was a horrible mistake, but I think that, you know, the role of our military is to follow the order of the person we elected to be president. And so my biggest issue with senior officers is that then they go into private practice, right? And they cash in and they advise companies on how to take advantage of the government and how to take advantage of endless wars. And that's where it really gets dirty, because then you have the private sector influencing policy and pushing for war and pushing for conflict. And I think that's the incredible thing, is just seeing, you know, a dozen of these people cash out, right, and then go and summer in this pristine enclave. I mean, to me, that's pretty insane and sickening. And one part I hope gets boosted more.
Yes, absolutely. Lastly, can you speak a little bit about it? We have an IM here, Hakeem's Nancy Davis Eyes, which is very, very obscure. One of the co-founders of the John Birch Society is the Koch brothers' father. I'm wondering if you think there's any connections with Bohemian Grove and John Birch's, the John Birch Society.
I mean, there probably is. There's a lot of people involved,
right.
But there's an interesting mix here, right, of like the sort of fiscal conservatives, but at the same time, they're doing this freakish stuff. And like, I think there's this famous Nixon quote where, you know, he called it like this weird, queer, gay, you know, thing where everyone's got their junk out and are pissing all over each other. And I think there is something interesting there, right, where it's kind of like the most extreme conservatives probably would flinch at what goes on there. And so it's mm-hmm. kind of this weird thing of old money. But
like the Epstein story, it's elites are playing
yes.
with their power
yes.
in debaucherous or rapacious ways
yes.
that is, I think, difficult for us to understand as regular people, why that kind of release for the powerful is both a camaraderie exercise and also another exercise of their power.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think that that's totally true. And that's an important piece that, like, I don't know, that I wish was discussed more, is that I think a lot of times this like stuff, whether it's like getting drunk and harassing people, or whether it's this idea of basically like, you know, sanctioned, accepted pedophilia, like, the motive for that, I think, in a lot of ways is this idea of taboo, right? This idea that you are so insulated from the normal laws,
yes.
you know, actual laws, but also social expectations of society, that you can engage in this, and that in engaging with it, you prove your membership to that club. And I think that's like, that's one of the really interesting things about Epstein, was it was kind of like, you see in some of these emails of people who, like, you know, there's no evidence of them engaging in pedophilia or in sex, but they're emailing with Epstein and they're kind of like, you dog, like, you love young women, right? Even Trump says that. And I think implicit in that is this acknowledgement of like, we're all part of this club. We all know you are violating the law and violating our normal moral ethical code. But by acknowledging that and being part of that, like, we are all part of this club. And like, I think that's been going on for thousands of years, right? I mean, I think that's how the elite works, you know, and it's not a genetic predisposition or something. It's a form of social cohesion.
Well said. Daniel Bogoslaw, thanks so much for coming on. Investigative journalist covering corporate crime, government agencies, and politics at Deeper States. Check him out on Substack. We'll put a link to that down below wherever people are listening to this or watching it. Daniel, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be speaking to the two elected co-chairs of the Democratic Socialists of America, Ashiq Sadiq and Megan Romer. We are back, and we are joined now by Ashiq Sadiq and Megan Romer, the two elected co-chairs of Democratic Socialists of America, here to talk about a major milestone in membership, 100,000 strong. Welcome to the show, you guys.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks so much for coming on. Megan, I'll turn to you first. Just speak a little bit about the surge in membership and how significant it is that DSA is at 100,000 members at this point.
Yeah, DSA 100K. This is something we've been working towards for a long time. It's extremely exciting. And just sort of seeing, you know, it's not just members in big cities, right? We have over 200 chapters across the country, over 100 YDSA chapters. And so, yeah, the surge, it's kind of a push factor, pull factor situation, right? There's a lot of excitement about Zohran Mamdani, obviously, but also some of our other candidates. We have lots of folks who've won office in municipal races and in state houses across the country, and those have really driven membership. But then, of course, there's the push factor also, which is the re-election of Trump and him being just an absolute ghoul for the last stretch of time for Trump too.
And Ashiq, how about the genocide in Gaza? Do you find that when you speak to members that have joined since October 2023 that was a motivating factor as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And even before that, Palestine organizing has been a critical factor that's brought people in, just anti-imperialism. I myself was really activated to pay attention more to politics through the Iraq War and just the global war on terror expanding. So I think a lot of us have been coming to a left, you know, a socialist analysis, an anti-imperialist analysis of, you know, what the United States has been doing all over the world. So since October 2023, it's been extremely activating. The anti-war movement has grown a lot, and DSA has been a core part of that. So we're really proud to be helping deepen the struggle for Palestine. It's brought a lot of people in. And just in the past 2 months, just to see the ways that the Trump administration is expanding the Monroe Doctrine, you know, calling it the Donroe Doctrine, that's been extremely activating. And we've had a whole analysis about why this is happening, why the United States is expanding this even further. It isn't starting with Trump. Trump is just exposing what has been happening for, you know, over a century now.
And Megan, when we're also looking at union membership ticking up slightly, even in spite of the Trump administration kind of just grinding the National Labor Relations Board to a halt. I saw there was a piece in Jacobin about that increase kind of being a bit disproportionate in the South, which is very exciting. Like, how do you see DSA's role in fitting into and supporting union drives and workers organizing across the country, and how that fits into the increase in membership?
Yeah, so it's, you know, we touch on labor from a bunch of different points. We have an organization that's a coalition of DSA and UE, the electricians union, United Electricians, and it's called EWOC. So cute, right? We love it. It's Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. And EWOC trains people to take on sort of new organizing. So you can kind of call into EWOC and say, hey, I'm having this problem in my workplace. What can I do? And they can coach you through a variety of options, whether, you know, if it makes sense to reach out to an existing union right now and unionize your shop from the jump, whether it makes sense to sort of think about escalating demands. And we're really able to train a lot of people through that program. And it's been really exciting. And we're seeing chapters take on and create local EWOCs. Where they're able to do that just really directly with folks in their city, get the kind of the labor knowers to transfer their knowledge to people who would like to learn. We also have coalition work with, you know, unions at a national level. And one of our priority campaigns right now is supporting Starbucks workers, which is an exciting, it's a great way for chapters that are maybe smaller, maybe chapters in the South that have really low union density that don't already have a bunch of union members in them to get out and connect with folks who are trying to unionize because there's a Starbucks everywhere, literally everywhere. So.
Yes, exactly right. Ashiq, can you speak a little bit about how ICE's attacks on Minnesota and other areas of the country have impacted DSA membership too? Because we're seeing how essential organizing is and kind of community connection and these networks in it's actually the only thing that is effective. Our politicians, the Democrats, are neutered, in, to put it mildly, and even the tools at like their disposal are insufficient with this kind of federal government crackdown. So I feel like more than ever, the central kind of community message of DSA is very, very poignant and fits the moment.
Yeah, for sure. So it's very clear that the capacities that DSA chapters all over the country have been building up for the better part of a decade now are really powerfully situating our chapters to respond against ICE. Our Minneapolis is a great example with our Twin Cities DSA chapter. Our Los Angeles DSA chapter was there when ICE started occupying last year. Chicago chapters like North New Jersey DSA, North Texas DSA are chapters that have built up capacities with labor unions, having workers in core unions and helping activate them to be involved in community organizing. Our community defense networks that have spun up in chapters like this, our socialists in office have been front and center using their platforms to advocate against collaboration with ICE. So what our chapters have been able to do in places like this, especially the past 2 months in Minneapolis, we've had rapid response networks, ICE Watch, organizing to stop local police departments from collaborating officially with ICE. We're doing Know Your Rights trainings, canvases of local businesses where people can be vulnerable to detentions and deportations, organizing to prevent new ICE facilities and economic disruptions, working with organized labor, doing court support. All these things are possible because of the ways that DSA chapters are already organizing, and it's come together really powerfully. So to see people in Minneapolis right now, I'm on a chapter visit. It's really impressive to see the ways that DSA members have been showing up with the broader community and the really strong, resilient networks that have come up that are organizing in all sorts of ways that are really activating civil society in ways that I haven't seen in my lifetime. It's a scary time, but it's a really exciting and hopeful time for a lot of people just feeling their collective power together.
And Megan, can you speak about how DSA works to collaborate globally with other leftist organizing and movements, particularly the Global South, for example?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So DSA is a member of Progressive International, which is an international, right? Like the old days. It's different parties and organizations from around the world who have this sort of connective tissue and opportunities to, learn from each other, to sort of use each other's on the ground analysis to kind of figure out what our next steps should be. It's really exciting to be able to work from and learn from, folks who are fighting U.S. imperialism from the other side, and figuring out sort of what they've done, what their analysis is, what it looks like on the ground, how even things like nitty gritty things, like how do you do new member onboarding? Like those are conversations that we have, which, there's so much to learn from each other, both macro and micro, and, being part of these coalitions is really powerful. And, Ashiq and I were able to go, to Sweden also recently. And, we were able to visit with the left party there, right before Zoran won office. So it was kind of fun to see like, okay, so, how do you govern?
Right.
What does this look like? You have some executive power here. We're curious. What does that look like for you? So we use those connections and those international. There's a lot of knowledge that has been developed around the world, and no reason to reinvent wheels that have been.
Well, I mean, it's essential because the global right is extremely well organized. Between Steve Bannon's like summits in Italy with a bunch of wannabe fascists where they're trying to style themselves as Viktor Orban types, and like just in how they borrow from one another, whether it's Trump and Milei, whether it's Trump and Orban, whether it's Trump and Netanyahu. I mean, I think that Trump enjoys like seeing how the Iranian regime is cracking down on protesters. Like there is more organization, and that is benefited by that's aided by capital. So we have to go with the people power piece. And I'm interested, Ashiq, if you could talk a little bit about how, like, what would you say DSA is most interested in building towards from like a policy perspective in the medium term? Like, would it be pushing for a Medicare for all or a universal healthcare type agenda? Is it about an arms embargo? And you know, there's sometimes critics that say that DSA shouldn't be working to elect people within the Democratic Party. I would argue it's the most efficient vehicle for that, but perhaps you could expand on the defense of that tactic.
Yeah, so from coast to coast right now, DSA chapters are organizing, especially around affordability and cost of living issues. This has been a core part of why Zoran Mamdani just caused so many, just activated such a powerful base in New York City. And our two largest chapters right now, New York City DSA and DSA Los Angeles, are campaigning to tax the rich to fund different initiatives toward the end of, you know, things that we talk about as just universal services. We really want to focus on things that we call transformative reforms or non-reformist reforms that help meet working class people's needs, but also raise expectations for what is possible and to activate people to organize in their own interests. So DSA chapters across the country are campaigning, you know, beyond electoral cycles on demands around rent control, like Zoran talks about freezing the rent, public transit, free and public buses and subways, universal childcare, and funding them by taxing the rich, just making the case about why these things are being blocked by the very powerful interests that you talk about all the time on the show. Just the, you know, all the Bohemian Grove people were against that. You know, we want everything for everyone. We want to campaign on deeply felt needs across the country beyond our own membership and identify the billionaires and their collaborators as the people who stand in the way. So you can see more about what our basic program is. It's called Workers Deserve More. If you just search platform.dsausa.org, that lays out all the things that we want to campaign on. And we're really highlighting chapters that are campaigning around these kinds of things. And we want to make the international connections too. Like you mentioned, labor for arms embargo, that's a core campaign priority for us right now, to activate people in labor unions to organize to and military aid to Israel, because organized labor is the backbone of anything that we're campaigning for, whether it's the climate crisis or internationalism or anything else. We want to make sure that workers are organizing in their own interests toward those things and shaping how those things happen. We're not just, you know, activists on the outside or people who elect, you know, good socialist branded people and then hope for the best. It's always about organizing everything together more powerfully. So you asked about the Democratic Party. We are trying to organize to throw out bad Democrats, but we're also building socialist power. And the point for us is to build independent power through our organization. Mm-hmm. DSA is now approaching the size of the Socialist Party over a century ago. So hopefully we'll surpass that soon. But the point for us is to just have independent, accountable power in elected office that's accountable to a democratic, small d democratic base to take on the establishment and the Republican and the Democratic Party. So mostly we do run people on the ballot line in primaries, on the Democratic Party ballot line, but we have our independent power and the Democratic Party leadership hates that. And we think that's great.
Well, I mean, and when we also support here on the show, when the situation applies, running a, say, an independent, like, I mean, the Dan Osborne candidacy is an example of something that I know this is not DSA, but like, you know, it's specific to the region, to the area where you're running. And in New York, the most effective vehicle to get socialist power is through the Democratic primary process, as we saw with Zoran Mamdani. And I really do think, and perhaps Megan, you can reflect on this, that his the way that he has governed here, it would not have been possible without DSA organizing, because it creates this kind of base of activation and support that allows him to act with the urgency that is required of the office, and that has been so, I think, admirable in how he has tried to just continuously be on offense, take the fight to the established powers. Like, what, when you reflect on that victory, how do you see how organizing emboldened the campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true for the Zoran Mamdani campaign. I think it is equally, if not even sometimes more so true, for some of our smaller municipal offices, the ones that aren't maybe as sort of big and attention getting because it's not New York City. and it's not the mayorality. But it's, you know, we see chapters who are able to use these municipal offices, city councilors and county government officials to really move like very specific agenda items, things like expanding transit, for example. And that doesn't have, you know, they're again, like we're talking push and pull factors, right? So you've got your pull factor is kind of the person in office. They're the ones who are kind of like, you know, able to move the messaging in a way that, you know, they have a platform and a mic and whatever. Your push factor is this organized mass of people who are able to, you know, show that, yes, there are big rallies lining up for comment at city council meeting. Not like the sexiest work, but really important and important to show all those sort of people who are on the fence, the sort of milquetoast Dems, the less engaged people, that like there is this movement here. You can be part of it. And it's, you know, here to hold you accountable. So I think you see that kind of at every level. I think, you know, for a lot of us, the Bernie campaign was the first time we kind of thought of politics like that, right? It used to be like you elect a person and then they do good, right? Mm-hmm. But that is, we sort of learned like, oh, this is a mass movement campaign. What does that mean? And we had to kind of rethink the way we thought about politics. And that's what we're trying to do here, get people to rethink the way they think about politics.
Yes, I think that last point is so key, because when you contrast it with, you know, there are reformer mayors and other examples of them, you know, the powers of capital like rush in. Brandon Johnson's an example, and it's just like smear campaign immediately. Everything kind of falls apart. You don't necessarily have the power base of people that protects you from the worst of the attempts to sabotage. Not saying they're equivalent politicians, but I just do think it's an interesting example. Go ahead.
Just to add to that about Zoran's power in New York City coming out of DSA and aligned organizations, it really can't be overstated for us just how much Zoran really comes out of New York City DSA. His work in the state assembly before he ran for mayor came out of the New York City DSA Socialists in Office block, which is really focused on building that kind of independent alignment of strategy to figure out with our membership, like what are the priorities in Albany at the state level of government. So DSA members organized in core labor unions and community groups, groups like Desi's Rising Up and Moving, which is a group of mostly South Asian immigrant workers and tenant organizers who built a really strong community base for years and were not represented in the political system. So Zoran's campaign identified pretty early on, like these are core parts of the working class in New York City, which is a very diverse city, including politically diverse. Like when I was growing up there, I'm from South Brooklyn, it was parts of the city were pretty conservative. So this is a really meaningful working class, diverse coalition that was organized, and New York City DSA members really helped do that. And that's how a bunch of labor unions came out early on, like public sector workers that would not have intervened if not for DSA members who are workers in those sectors making the case for why this was a viable alternative that was worth fighting for. And that's the base of him being able to do anything in office.
Exactly. Exactly right. Two quick IMs and then we'll let you go. One for each of you. Alex Andert says, where did he get that rad sweatshirt?
Oh, wow. This is product placement. I think you can check out Dream NYC. If you just Google Anti-Billionaire Socialist Club. We also have plenty of great merch in our DSA store. Yeah, go for it. Megan's rocking our hat right now.
Yes, the hat is rad as well. And then we have another IM. This is a nice Floridians for Emma. Thank you. Sorry you're in Florida, although I'm sure the weather's better than here. Got to meet Megan about a month ago during a chapters tour. She is incredible. So happy you had her and Ashik on. Everyone listening should go find their local chapter and just attend an event. There's an incredible movement growing each day, even in the most unexpected places. We are always stronger together.
I was just going to say that hitting 100,000, we got like what? About 100,000 people that listen to this show on a daily basis. Let's get that up to like 5,000. Let's get 5,000 people sign up.
USA.org/join.
Yes.
Help us beat the historical Socialist Party. I think they had 112,000 or 118 maybe, so we can surpass that pretty soon if you join.
We're still seeing
membership numbers have not been dropping. You know, the uptick, it's not quite the surge it was like the day after Zoran got elected, but still definitely an upward trajectory as our chapters recruit people in their communities with the work they're doing. And yeah, it's exciting.
Well, very exciting stuff. Ashiq Sadiq, Megan Romer, the co-chairs elected to lead the Democratic Socialists of America. Lots of internal democracy in DSA. Quite the contrast to the Democratic Party saying, no, Biden's the nominee. You better deal with it. That's not the kind of thing you're going to find in DSA. The messiness of democracy, but also the beauty of it, is very present in DSA membership. So appreciate you guys. Thank you so, so much. And we will put a link down below for people to learn more about joining DSA in the video and episode descriptions. Yep. Thank you, guys. Thanks so much. All right, folks. With that, we're going to wrap up the free part of this program and head into the fun half, where we will take your calls, read your IMs, do all of that fun stuff. We will be celebrating Brandon Sutton's fourth birthday of the week. Is that what we're talking about here? That's right. We can hear him.
Wait 1 second. Brandon's not in yet.
Brandon's not yet, and we can't hear him cheering on what I'm advocating for, the continued celebration of Brandon's birthday.
Right.
4 days in.
That's
there
right.
There you
Four
go.
4 days in. I'm Royal Tenenbaum maxing tonight, too.
What does that mean?
I got my whole sweatsuit
slitting your
on.
Wrists in a bathroom?
No.
Sorry.
Doing light incest?
Wow. I just meant wearing a tracksuit. I guess I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
Yeah. I mean, isn't there incest in that movie?
I think it's implied between Luke Wilson and his sister.
Yes.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Again, yeah. It's Gwyneth Paltrow. Yeah. Yeah.
Not my favorite.
I'm not a huge Wes Anderson person. I'm fine. But it's like, I feel like once I've seen one,
like
you've kind of seen them all. What?
Well,
I like
I'm,
that one.
I'm yeah. That's one you like, right? I like colors because I'm simple, and so I like his movies because they're very colorful. I think he's my favorite Anderson director amongst the Paul W.S. and Wes Anderson trifecta.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
But Paul W.S. is obviously a really good director.
I guess my favorite's The Grand Budapest Hotel. I like that movie, but yeah. Anyway.
I like Resident Evil 1 with Mila Jovovich.
I got sidetracked. What is happening on the discourse, Brandon? Birthday Brandon.
We have been celebrating my birthday this week, which was Monday, and obviously some people feel like that's a little bit indulgent. I disagree, and I would also point out that they hated on Jesus too, if you'll recall from mm-hmm. your Bible lessons, that they hated on Jesus. And so when you adopt that posture,
hating on Jesus.
Yeah, when you adopt that posture aimed towards me, you also are in many ways, I guess, like mirroring the people who crucified Christ for being the son of the Lord or the Lord himself. I don't know. Again, I haven't watched VeggieTales in many years, which is kind of the theme of my birthday. So what we're going to be doing tomorrow is continuing our live watch. Well, I guess live watch, but watch through of the Candace Owens, Erica Kirk documentary, which we almost got through the entire first episode today when Candace took a turn towards a more obscure type of bigotry than we were expecting. And so tomorrow we'll be continuing that for the fifth day of my birthday celebration. So if you want to figure out which group Candace is racist against this week, you'll have to either tune into the discourse or watch her show yourself, which I would not recommend because of the immense psychic damage it might do to you. So
absolutely.
Go to the page, the discourse with Brandon.
Brandon,
Twitch.
You're that meme of the guy with standing, the soldier with his arms out in front of that child with all these knives going into their back.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
protecting all of the precious audience members from the psychic damage of Candace Owens because they don't have your brain capacity to take it on.
I like to think of myself as that little like box that you can make out of like toilet paper tubes and like milk cartons that you use to look at eclipsoids,
mm-hmm.
To avoid going blind. Obviously, like our president, Donald Trump, did not require such a box, but I would not suggest you engaging in that behavior without me.
I well said that you are You are the cardboard tube box to protect people from the eclipse.
Eclipsoid.
Well, you know.
Okay, yeah. That's where we've landed. Whoa, and then we lost Matt Binder for a sec. Do we have him back?
Okay. Binder might need to reconnect. His connection hasn't been stable, if you can hear us, Matt.
Well, you know, I will say, allow me to say, even though Matt probably can't hear it, that for my birthday, I've been feeling extra grateful this year. And I do want to say live in front of a studio audience that I'm extra grateful for the Majority Report family for, aww, you know, everything you've done to enrich me, not just when I've been on the show, but for the years that I watched the show. This is obviously very applicable to Matt Binder, who's not quite here right now. So you'll have to report this to him later. But I'm really appreciative of the ways in which you've enriched me and helped me grow intellectually and emotionally in terms of like community. And I don't say that enough to people.
No,
I'm crying. So,
well, I feel the same way about you, Brandon. I learn something new every time we have a conversation. I think about something differently every time you say something, like, you know, at least once a show. So we love you. Happy birthday 4 days later, even though I already texted you about this, but we're here to be indulgent.
I love you all too.
Yes, very cheers. Sweet. So thanks so much. This is the kind of sincerity I'm usually the only one that engages in. So I love it.
Everyone's
they're all sweating.
I this was Sam and us.
I live wept on my stream on Monday. But on Tuesday, in appreciation of all of you in my audience. And I'm not ashamed to say it, because like tier maxing is the new meta.
That's how Jordan Peterson got to us. You gotta clip that.
Yeah, that's Jordan Peterson's technique. It works. A lot of perverts out there. They love when you start crying.
Are you joking? Clips of me crying? It's like people run with it. Run with it.
She's sad about what's happening in Gaza.
I'm sad Trump won the election, shit lib.
Exactly. You know what? They can't appreciate it, because like when they're crying over silly things like the Cracker Barrel logo being changed or like Charlie Kirk, if any such person existed, we're crying over real things like my birthday and the degradation of American society.
Hello, Matt Binder.
Hello. My internet went down at the wrong time. I missed out on a lot of what Brandon was saying, and it sounds like it was very emotionally charged.
Well, luckily,
I won't start crying again.
Luckily, it's recorded, so you can go back and relive it in that
true.
Way. Matt Binder, what's happening with your shows?
Not much. I don't even know if there's a Leftist Mafia tonight. I'll let everybody know. Everyone's busy today, but there might be, there might not be. I guess youtube.com/Matt Binder, subscribe there, and if we're live, you'll get the notification.
Matt Leck, what's happening on Left Reckoning and the Jackman Show?
Left Reckoning, we had a show on Tuesday. Go check that out. And we got a Sunday show for people on patreon.com/Left Reckoning coming up for Sunday members. And Jackman Show tomorrow on Iran and why it would be bad if we bombed Iran.
Yeah.
And I'm very glad that in the time since we recorded that earlier this week, we haven't bombed Iran yet. Thank God.
Thank God. All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. As a reminder, the show relies on your support. Join themajorityreport.com. You can IM the show. You can become a member. Even if you don't feel like IMing, it helps us stay resilient as we are on third-party platforms that can make determinations about us on a whim. And without members, we would not be able to do what we do. So join themajorityreport.com. All right. See you in the fun half.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the Majority Report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
I think you need to take over for Sam.
Yes, please.
I'm gonna pause you right there.
Wait, what?
You can't encourage Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why.
So it was offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Sushi and poker with the boys. Who was offered a tour?
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
What?
Tour? Sushi and poker.
Tim's upset.
Tour?
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys. Who was offered a tour? Sushi and
that's what we call the biz.
Tour? Sushi and poker.
Yeah, what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Look at how sad he's become now. You shouldn't even talk about it. I think you're responsible.
I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Twerk, ugh, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Twerk,
wow.
Sushi.
I'm sorry, I'm losing my fucking mind.
Someone's offered to twerk,
yeah.
Sushi, and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Twerk, sushi, and poker with the boys. Boy,
twerk.
I think I'm like a little kid. I think I'm like a kid. Twerk. I think I'm like a little kid.
Add this debate 7,000 times.
I'm a little kid. I think I'm like a little kid.
I'm losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing me with a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here.
It's not a fun job. Twerk?
That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
Boss. Willy Wonka.
Twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's real thing.
Real
thing.
What's that?
Offered to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's real thing.
Real thing.
Boss. That's
twerk.
A real thing.
That's real thing.
Real thing.
Boss.
That
offered to twerk?
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offered to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's
poker with the boys.
I think he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's
poker with the boys.
That offered to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's
poker.
Let's go, Joe.
Twerk.
Sushi.
Take it easy, then.
Twerk,
sushi, and poker.
Things have really gotten out of hand.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Delusional.
Twerk.
Deluded.
Sushi.
You don't have a clue as to what's going on.
Live YouTube.
Sam has
Twitch,
the weight of the world on his shoulders.
Poggers.
Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore.
Can't do it anymore.
It was so much easier when the Majority Report was just you.
Let's change the subject.
Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's
now,
one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is the pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time we bury the hatchet.
Left is best. Trump violet
twerk.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me and don't bitch. The way Emma has cucked all of these people.
Love it. That's where my heart is, so yeah. I wrote my honors thesis about it.
Oh, she wrote an honors thesis. I should hand the main mic to you now.
You are to the right of me on foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against that?
That's a tougher question. I don't have an answer to.
Incredible theme song.
Hi, Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like, period.
Back.
We are back, and you guys don't even want to know what we were just talking about in the break. And you'll never know.
You don't want to know.
You don't even want to know.
Definitely don't want to know.
Mike Drumi says, happy birthday, Brandon. I joined DSA as a birthday present to you. Don't worry. I also gave you my Prime sub on Twitch. Woo!
We love
you know
to
what?
Hear that.
I love to hear that, but if you have the option of doing one or the other, I would suggest you absolutely go out and join either DSA or any other local organization. Get involved, PSL, mutual aid organizations. You know, that can be your birthday gift to me. Don't donate to the Discord. We do rely on that. But if you're forced to choose, I think it's way more valuable for you to get active in your community, you know, because I, you know, and I'll do it too. I should be more active as well. So we'll make that pledge to each other for my birthday.
Here.
I will say, though, that more people should be reminded to use that Twitch Prime subscription. Like, a lot of people sign up to Amazon Prime to get the free delivery and don't realize that you get a free Twitch subscription to your favorite creator every single month, and you basically are giving them free money.
Nice.
That just Amazon keeps if you don't use it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I would guess that, like, if every Amazon Prime subscriber who watches this show would use it every month, they could probably give, like, a lot of money.
That's true.
And Bezos wouldn't have to send it out, shoot it off into space.
Yeah. Tim from Boston. Graham Platner was a guest on Office Hours with Tim Heidecker today. No way.
That's funny.
That's amazing. J-Man J's. I watch Brandon every morning before going to work out. Very chill. If you don't watch, you're not left maxing. Cole
it's
from Cincinnati. Time. Brandon is the watcher on the wall, the shield in the night. Okay. Obviously, that's a reference to Game of Thrones, but okay.
I have no idea. I'm like, is this Dungeons & Dragons or something?
I've never heard of it. Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Baratheon or whatever.
Yeah, My husband's really into the book series, and the amount that it was brought up at speeches in our wedding, where we basically just kind of like stopped the fandom after the show butchered it so intensely, but people were using like anecdotes from 4 years ago. I think everybody Ooh. Brought up Game of Thrones. Yeah. It was sweet. Margo from Mass, happy birthday, Brandon. You can celebrate for the whole year. It is amazing how, it is amazing how Game of Thrones, has there ever been a show where the finale is so, and the final season is so bad that it's just like wiped from cultural memory?
I feel like it happened to a lesser extent with Lost.
Lost and Dexter, I know people really hate the final season of Dexter.
Heroes was also kind of wiped out by like the writer's strike, that really big writer's strike. So there were a lot of shows that got like really derailed back in like the early mid aughts by that like writer's strike, and they never recovered. That's when Trump also came to ascendance because of him being like on Celebrity Apprentice at the time, like the only, I guess, in people's mind, good show.
Yes. Yes.
They should have, looking back, obviously this is like Monday morning quarterbacking, but looking back, they should have just never completed the final season, just like he never completed the book.
Yeah.
And then people would be so into these spin-off series because they would be like consuming it, assuming that the final season of the main show is eventually coming up, but right. just never delivered.
Let's do eight here, the more substantive thing, and then we'll get into some more fun stuff. Because this morning, in kind of the DC News punch bowl type reporting that
the
we
Beltway
read.
Media.
The Beltway Media, thank you. They basically highlighted the fact that Senate Majority Leader John Thune is unlikely to acquiesce to the demands of the Trump administration to nuke the filibuster to pass the SAVE Act. And for people that don't know, the SAVE Act is this mass voter disenfranchisement bill that the far right has been pushing, and that includes the man in the White House, Donald Trump. But also, you know, Mike Johnson passed this in the House, and apparently Thune's been annoyed because the Senate doesn't have the votes that it needs to pass it. You would need 60 votes. Of course, no Democrat is going to support this. And you already have Republicans like the senator from North Carolina, who's outgoing, Tillis, who are saying that they're not going to support it. So you would need to have just a simple majority, but you would have to get rid of the filibuster for that. And the filibuster disproportionately protects Republicans. And we just lost Binder again. Binder's internet is having some issues. We will go back to a two shot, but
filibuster disproportionately protects.
Yes, it disproportionately affects, and we have Binder back. Disproportionately helps Republicans because there was a period of time during the Biden administration where it was 50 Democratic senators and 50 Republican senators, and the 50 Democratic senators represented 40 million more people than the Republican ones. So the Senate is already an undemocratic institution. And when you make it a 60 vote threshold for most legislation, you're giving them even more power when they already have a crazy amount of power. And yes, I noticed that my camera is having some issues. Hopefully you guys can hear me okay regardless. So here is Mehdi Hasan breaking down, though, what this bill actually does. And I think he does a really good job here, because even if they're not able to pass this in the immediate future in the Senate, these are still the kinds of measures that Republicans are trying to implement to make sure that the fewest amount of people possible vote. Because if you're wealthier and you're older, you have the ability, you'll have the documentation that they're talking about. You'll have the ability to vote. You have maybe the time and the resources to have the identification and then also to vote. And so that's why the Republicans are interested in it. But it's really, really extreme. And here's Mehdi's very, very good breakdown.
President Donald Trump and the GOP have decided to resurrect a controversial bill from last year, the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act, also known as the Save America Act. The new version of the bill has already passed the House and is being framed as a set of common sense measures to protect U.S. elections, including requiring Americans to present photo ID when voting, something over 80% of Americans support. Now, what's controversial about that, you might say? Sounds kind of reasonable, no? If only. Unfortunately, this innocently named bill is about so much more than voter ID and could be, perhaps, Trump's most severe threat to our free and fair election so far. Let me explain. For starters, the bill would require Americans to provide proof of U.S. citizenship when registering to vote, meaning they would need to show documents like a U.S. passport or birth certificate with their full name on it, which millions of Americans cannot readily access. For example, over half of all Americans don't have an up-to-date passport, an issue that's even more pronounced in red states. Of course, per the bill, you could just show your birth certificate if you're a U.S.-born citizen and are able to find it. But more than 1 in 10 registered voters don't actually have access to their birth certificate. Heck, even J.D. Vance, who's gone through several name changes since his birth, could run into trouble if his passport suddenly gets lost down the back of his couch. But just producing a birth certificate still may not be enough for the nearly 70 million married women whose last names no longer match the ones on their birth certificates. Republicans say, no big deal. They can just show their marriage licenses too. But the bill itself makes no mention of marriage licenses and leaves it up to individual states
Pause
to sort
it.
Out any...
I did not know this. So we... This is amazing to me. I did not know this and why I love this breakdown here. So that's 70 million married women who have changed their names around and won't be able to use their birth certificates as a way to identify themselves in this instance.
Yeah.
And so the Republicans will say publicly, well, you could just, you know, use your marriage license then, which will indicate your name change. But the text of the bill says that will be determined on a state-by-state basis. Like, when you have the Trump administration openly talking about, like, the Monroe Doctrine, you hear how Trump is obsessed with William McKinley. They literally want to return us to a pre-women's suffrage period. I mean, that, like, I'm not trying to be extreme in saying that they're going to be able to do that, but they are at the very least nostalgic for it. And this bill opens the door for there to be restrictions on women voting. And we know that women are more likely to vote Democrat than they are than men are. And do you remember that ad from the 2024 race when it was they were so mad about that Kamala Harris ad, I think, that said, shh, you don't have to tell your husbands that you're voting for Kamala.
Yeah.
Didn't work that well. But I do think that that taps into like a right-wing fear about the agency of their wives, about women having a kind of different political bent than perhaps their husbands would want. And it's very Orban style, keep the woman barefoot in the kitchen kind of thing. And that the household
or Peter Thiel.
And the household should be voting essentially as a unit, and that can be determined by the husband. So I didn't know this fact about this bill, and it was just very shocking to me to see that they give states an opening really to restrict women from voting.
I'm not surprised, though, because I think one thing that has been noted about the Trump administration's, well, first term, but also second term, is that perhaps more than the antagonisms of previous Republicans, it's so defined by like misogyny. It feels like it's so defined by like the incel culture online, the alpha male podcast, the divorced dad aesthetic of Kid Rock. And so, you know, a lot of what those guys are obsessed with is the sexual liberation movement. For them, the influx of women into the workplace as represented by like HR or nurses or teachers, like, is the worst thing that ever happened, because it, you know, it maps onto everything that's wrong with society. And, you know, it does map onto neoliberal politics gripping the United States in such a way that has definitely materially deprived Americans of the opportunities that their parents and grandparents had. But that's just correlation, right? The influx of women into the workplace, of Black people into the workplace, of migrants in from the global South to the global North during like the 80s and 70s is not the cause of like the degradation of our society. But for, radical reactionary online, it's very easy for them to believe that. And this tactic of tying voter ID to like IDs that certain groups are more likely to have is just the classic way in which it becomes like disenfranchisement, because that's what it is, right? It sounds so reasonable at the surface level. It sounds so reasonable because like, why shouldn't you need an ID to vote? But then you get down to the nitty gritty of the fact that Americans aren't guaranteed IDs like some countries guarantee citizens or a resident's ID easily. The fact that, and oftentimes operationally in these states, they will disallow for IDs that are most held by Democratic leaning voters. Like they'll allow you to vote for people using your NRA membership, but not your student ID at the local or like at the state college, because that'll be more likely to be Democrats. And so we just have a long history of disenfranchisement in the United States of America that has to be taken into consideration when anything like this is coming into effect. And people just want you to forget that. They want to go like, oh, well, like, yeah, we've been disenfranchising people since we've been giving them the right to vote, but don't consider that when you look at this particular bill.
Right. I mean, with this specific thing, it's interesting because they're essentially saying, and this is if this particular state even allows it, but let's say they do, they're essentially saying that married women actually need to bring two different forms of identification, because a marriage certificate doesn't necessarily mean you have the right to vote. People get married to non-citizens and people who can't vote all the time. I mean, mm-hmm. just having a marriage certificate with your name on it doesn't mean you're eligible to vote.
And yeah, but yeah, oh, go ahead, Brandon.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, but the next line says, and this is like the really egregious part, that if you're like a divorced man, you get two votes.
They call that the Steven Crowder clause.
Yeah.
But
Crowder caucus.
The disenfranchisement of like people of color is obviously also like the major thrust of this. I just the women part, it's not being talked about enough, and I was really shocked to see it. But I shouldn't be that shocked. There are over 140 million Americans who don't have a passport, which is, you know, it's more than half of Americans, or an up to date passport,
which is a class divided thing.
The whole thing
costs,
is a class thing.
It costs money to get all ID, but passport's pretty significant. If you're
it's over $100.
Yeah, if you're not planning on using it because you're going on a trip outside the country, why would you get a passport? I mean, I have an expired passport because I needed it to travel once. I think maybe I used it twice, but I haven't had any plans of traveling, so I haven't renewed it. I mean, that's just how it is.
And it's really hard to get them now, right?
Yes.
Because like there was a lot of defunding of the public sector that was done under COVID and just the decades before that too, where, you know, it's difficult in some places to get a passport appointment. It's difficult. You have to like try to find a free post office or whatever that still does them at a free time slot that might just be on a day you don't have off from work. Like when I got my passport renewed, I had to do an emergency appointment at like the building in the middle of Manhattan because I had a flight the next day.
And this bill requires you to register in person. That's also a big part of this. So it's going to impact people who are disabled. It's going to impact rural voters if they're far away from their election offices. It's making registering to vote like the passport process that you're talking about here, which is already insane. Another stat I saw is that around half of Black Americans under 30 don't have an ID with their current name and address. So it's targeting younger Black voters. Younger voters in general also are less likely to have this. So it's just, I mean, Thune not nuking the filibuster for this reason is probably also self-interested, I'd say. One, because of what I just mentioned, how the filibuster, the Republicans, like, it's a tool that it's disproportionately helpful to them. And I think Thune, coming from the McConnell mentorship, is aware of that, but he's sparring with Mike Johnson, who is just Mr. Cuck to Donald Trump, and the House is just completely unwieldy in that area. And so they're more responsive to it. It's less strategic. They understand that rural states, like for a senator who has to win statewide office in a really, really rural state, if they're in a red state, this could be really, really difficult for them if this actually goes into effect. Like, the knock-on effects for Republicans aren't exactly clear. And so Thune is doing the smart thing. But it is also another lesson here. If they are even entertaining getting rid of the filibuster for this purpose. No Democratic presidential candidate in 2028 should stand on that stage and say that they want to preserve the filibuster. It's disqualifying.
I mentioned Teal because I think when you see this thing, especially about women and like needing a marriage license to vote, well, like, and people might think that's pretty extreme. There are people that want that. There's this, this is from a guy, John Brockman, who is Jeffrey Epstein's sort of liaison. He's a science publisher, but he's also one of the guys setting up Epstein's meetings with people like Elon Musk or Peter Thiel. There's this email here before when Epstein is looking around trying to maybe get a connection with Thiel. And he says, I'm on the case, Reteal. Let's talk tomorrow. I'm at the farm. But why Thiel, another libertarian type, and not Elon Musk, a truly brilliant physicist who you'd benefit from knowing? And the guy says to Epstein of this little section about Peter Thiel, Peter Thiel professes that he is unable to engage in what he terms unacceptable compromise politics, considers democracy a failed experiment, drawing into doubt the, quote, wisdom of granting the poor... drawing into doubt, quote, the wisdom of granting women and the poor voting rights. This position received hard criticism. And guess what? Epstein still wanted to meet him. Turns out, let's still sign up that meeting. These are the people that are running the world. Our government is giving these people big contracts. If we weren't giving people like Peter Thiel contracts or Elon Musk contracts, we wouldn't hear about them. They're not making their money through the market. They're making it through contracts and gaming like tax systems and stuff like that.
Right.
Relatedly,
although it would have been something if Epstein was like, I draw the line at not supporting women's rights.
I'll just say Brockman there's a piece in him in the Chronicle of Higher Education that goes into how he would sometimes reach out to these men in science and just casually mention, oh yeah, Jeffrey Epstein has young female assistants. So,
relatedly, headline that I read earlier today, but DCCC, DCCC, which is the Democrats' Congressional Campaign Committee for the House, DCCC rakes in millions from Palantir lobbyists as protests target the company's ICE surveillance tools. That's a report from Sludge. So there you have it. Maybe let's just do 13 and 14 while we're here. So Ilhan Omar was one of the very few Democrats at the State of the Union that chose to vocalize disgust, anger, outrage towards Donald Trump spewing a bunch of lies in a really boring and lazy way, in between talking about his wife, in between parading the men's hockey team into the State of the Union. He sprinkled in lots of lies about Minnesota, and Ilhan Omar seated next to Rashida Tlaib, two of really our best elected federal representatives, pushed back against Trump and yelled at him. And a woman yelling? A woman of color yelling? A woman of color in a hijab yelling? How do you think Fox News is going to react to this? With some weird horniness, I bring you Greg Gutfeld.
I have to point out Ilhan Omar. She repulses me, and I'm trying to find out why, because she's not unattractive.
Wow.
She has an unusual amount.
Yeah, record scratch.
Jesus. Wow.
Let's pause for a second.
Wow. Wow, Rumpelstiltskin has some real opinions about like conventional beauty standards. Crazy what goes on the five.
I also just like the opening kind of premise, which is that he's talking about a politician and a female politician and being repulsed by her. You would think that because this is a political channel, it might be related to her ideology. Like, I'm repulsed by Greg Gutfeld, not because of how he looks. He's fairly standard white man. I'm repulsed by his ideology, but for a woman, I mean, how could he even think about her on a substantive level if he's not first analyzing her attractiveness?
This is a man who can't understand
all
his erection.
No, yeah. He's definitely straight, you know? Like, you can't call her unattractive and not people question your the Fox viewer questioning, you know, what you're into, you know? So he has to let her know that he thinks she is attractive because, of course, he's a straight guy.
Yeah,
classic case of not gays.
I swear, like, half the, they're imagining, like, Ilhan Omar, like, taking her hair down or something. Like
I really think that's what it is. Yeah. I mean, they're catching up. They've already been on the psychosexual AOC beat where they are all attracted to her.
And
but
she
they're,
wears lipstick.
But they're scared by it because she's Latino and is a forceful lefty in the context of the Democratic Party. But they're now, I guess they're catching up to Ilhan Omar now. They've seen past the hijab and realized that she's also a very beautiful woman. Shout out to Ilhan. She's got it. She's pretty. Yeah.
I just want to add quickly that I'm also repulsed by Greg Gutfeld's sense of humor, but yes. That's like a separate thing.
But I know why.
Right. all right. Start from the beginning.
I have to point out Ilhan Omar. She repulses me, and I'm trying to find out why, because she's not unattractive. It's she has an unusual.
It's the racism, buddy.
Kind of anger. Mm-hmm. She has no right to that level of rage in the United States of America.
Can you pause it?
Her corrupt ass.
I'm sorry. What do you mean she has no right? Does Trump have the right to have all of his rageful outbursts as a guy born with a still silver spoon or a golden spoon up his ass? But she doesn't have the right to have rage. She was born in a. She's a refugee who like survived. Horrible war-torn situations, and you are terrorizing her community. She represents the very community that is like being attacked. Her constituents were murdered by the guy standing in front of her. She doesn't have a right to feel rage. She should just sit there and look pretty for Greg Gutfeld, and maybe he'd hate her a little bit less, which I'm sure
Greg
she's
Gutfeld.
Really concerned about.
Greg Gutfeld doesn't have the right to ride certain roller coasters.
I mean, if the standard is that Ilhan Omar has not experienced enough to have rage in her throughout her life, like who does have the right?
Well, right.
Someone mad about, you know, I think we mentioned earlier the changing logo of the Cracker Barrel. Yeah. I mean, who
real
has
issues.
The ability
real like
to
that.
Rage?
That's valid.
Real issues like that and, you know, the loss of Donald Trump's best friend, Jeffrey Epstein, are the only two things you're allowed to be angry about in the modern American society.
Oh, yeah. We're not done talking about pedophiles in this segment, but we can continue.
Can't even read going. Dr. Yeah. Seuss to my child girlfriend anymore.
Biden's America.
She has no right to that level of rage in the United States of America, the country who gave her corrupt ass a new life. It's not like she's a homeless Vietnam vet who can't get services and should be
like a Burmese one that was left to die on the side of the road by ICE.
Yeah.
Little yeah. Freaking
also
hobbit.
Updated to Iraq and admit the world.
He didn't support
now.
That either.
Yeah. Enraged at the government. She should be kissing the ground she walks on instead of spitting on it. And her anger is also reminds me of the radical who, given power, would destroy you. She would show no mercy.
Sexually.
To you if you were...
if you're tied
below.
Down
can you buy it?
In a milking chamber.
She reminds me of the radical that I want to step on my balls.
Puts me in restraints.
Yeah. Do you think... It's all psychosexual. Do you think that, like, video of her almost beating up that guy who sprayed apple cider vinegar on her, like, kind of
yes.
got them all, like, anxious? They got
yep.
them all, like, feely?
That was their spunning moment. That was it.
Sexual awakening.
Yes. I mean, it was for AOC dancing in college. That's what did it for them. And then when Ilhan Omar was about to throw down, then they were like, oh, you mix violence and sexuality? I'm a right winger. I'm into that kind of thing.
They were waiting for the 18-year-old Ilhan Omar clip of her dancing, but it never came. So this was the next best thing.
Yes.
You know?
There you go.
Her face is somebody who would step on your neck instead of giving you a hand.
Oh my job!
I knew that was coming, so I was
freezing.
Oh, I didn't get that far. Oh my god!
She would put a stiletto right in your fucking testicles.
It's like, I mean, honestly, if that there's a woman out on the panel. I know there are women on this panel at the Five. Like, they've got to be a little uncomfortable that he's basically erect right now.
Well, you're wrong about that. Because okay. you get a glimpse into that.
Thank you. Thank you. I shouldn't pause it so much. Keep going.
Would destroy you. Oh. She would show no mercy for you if you were below her.
J-O-I.
Like the below her.
Beneath her?
Who would step on your neck instead of giving you a hand.
Job.
And that is not the kind of person we should have in our leadership. It's not the type of person we should have in this country. And if we find out that she screwed up on her immigration stuff, she's got to go.
Yeah. She should be thanking President Trump for finding fraud.
Yeah, see?
President Trump didn't find that, you fucking moron. That was found in the previous administration. Like, did anybody have object permanence or, like, basic chronology? Like, President Trump saved us.
No. I mean,
That's been an ongoing issue for quite some time now. They don't know the time frame of anything anymore. Everything bad that ever happened under Trump somehow actually happened under a different president.
I think what's getting them messed up is like they're trying to center everything around when Jeffrey Epstein died, and so like that has to be under Obama now because it doesn't suit their narrative that it all happened under Trump. And so Obama was president way longer than you know people in reality remember.
For folks just curious to look into the sourcing for the claims by folks that Ilhan married her brother, made by folks like Tucker Carlson, for instance, the anti-Zionist. GOP strategist, a GOP strategist arrested for underage sex trafficking. Oh, yeah, this is the guy. This is the guy who was making the claims. Anton Lazaro, a young Republican strategist and former congressional campaign manager in Minnesota, arrested for underage sex trafficking charges Tuesday morning, according to federal law enforcement. He was basically doing gate stuff. He had women who he was paying through Venmo and another young woman who was there to, like, groom girls at, I believe it was St. Francis College. In Minnesota. This is just the type of people who work for Republicans. And it's pedophilia all the way down.
Dmitry Medvedev, I am Greg Gutfelding. We are back to my confusing boner.
If you were beneath her, she would.
That's what the five means.
yeah.
Sorry. Wait, I don't even get it.
Inches.
Oh.
Chicago Tim, this dude is really telling on himself. Ryan from Florida, Greg Gutfeld secretly thought I wish he'd spit on me. Galactic Nurse Bugs. I wonder if Ilhan Omar was Tucker Carlson's succubus. I'm sorry, Ilhan, if you ever see this, if that image was put in your brain. The Wu-Tang Forever.
For folks who don't know what that reference is, Tucker Carlson says it's a mysterious... that he woke up with scratches all over his body one day.
Yeah.
And it's especially mysterious because the dogs he sleeps with, the large dogs. Yeah, the three large dogs he sleeps with didn't seem to react to the ghost that clearly scratched him. It definitely wasn't scratched by his own dogs.
Yeah. Take him to the groomers, man.
This guy is all right. Emma's really fixated on balls today. You know what? Yes, there was a theme twice, but I feel like it was a happy accident. I think so.
She was offered a tour, accident. Sushi, and poker with the boys.
The Mill Rind. Gutfeld has a micro penis, so you have to forgive him. Okay.
He's a micro guy.
Okay, one more on this, because 14. Bill Maher and Andrew Schultz got together, I guess, and...
This is old, but it's like from last year, but I thought it paired nicely with Gutfeld.
Okay, yeah, let's play it for a sec.
It's the sort of thing that Andrew Schultz says I didn't vote for this.
right.
What did you propagandize for, though, you
40-year-old
man?
He tries to kind of – he's better than Bill Maher in this. That's the best I can give him.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, but when you say Bill Maher, you know it's going to be like a sexually normal clip. Like it's gonna
you're
be,
right.
Exactly.
Well, this combines weird. A lot of things that are really, really difficult for Bill Maher, which are women that are over the age of 25, women that have opinions, and also a Muslim woman, because Bill Maher is one of the most prominent anti-Muslim bigots who doesn't get called out for it. Who isn't like explicitly associated with the Republican Project. When I was dabbling in atheism as a teenager, I was watching a lot of Bill Maher, but one of the like political awakenings I had was realizing, he says he's an atheist, but he's super, super bigoted towards Muslim people. And Sam Harris was another one of those folks.
I mean, Bill Maher recently cited the Bible as reason Israelis get to take land in the Middle East.
He is a non-practicing Jewish, or I don't know what his religion is, but at the very least, he is a Zionist. And but he's just one that doesn't believe in God. So he really doesn't like Muslim people.
He also believes just generally in American power. He, in the late 90s, was defending having invaded Vietnam because we had to show the world we had the power. Like, he's a belligerent sort of imperialist.
He believes that Islam is inherently more violent than other religions. So it's like not true and body total, and it's also just deeply, deeply offensive. But here we go. This is from last year.
Dude, I wonder if, like, and again, I don't know too much about, like, the Ilhan Omar's politics or whatever.
Ilhan Omar.
You call her Ilhan Omar?
I call her that because that's her name. She's the representative from
Minnesota.
Minnesota.
I think, whatever.
Maybe I'm saying it wrong.
Ilhan, I thought it was. But I guess, I think that, like...
Whatever it is, I don't like her.
So the point that I'm trying to make here is that, like...
Is she a representative of America or Palestine, is my question.
Well, here's the thing.
Oh,
important.
My it's God.
Like, I think that she has the... And I don't even know if she understands this as privilege, but, like, she has an identity outside of being American. Like, she has this separate identity from another country that has thousands of years of history, and that's baked into who she is. Some of us...
Where you would happily live.
Well, where I would happily live. Like, and it would be so great. So,
and you know, she married her brother.
And it is what it is.
So you could do that.
I mean, if I had a sister,
You can marry your sister. I don't know what you could do.
But the point is,
you could do anything to a woman. Okay, so let's just put that right on the table.
So the point I'm trying to make is, like, some of us only have America. We only have this. So America. When you attack this, I'm going to defend it till the day I die. I love America more than anything in the entire world. It's the greatest country in the human existence. It's the greatest experiment in human existence. And
I'm sorry. It was fucking two Americans that had nothing else, like as Ilhan Omar apparently does. It's two Americans that were killed by fucking ICE.
What is he talking? They also don't know where she's from. They don't know. When he says Palestine, she's from Somalia. Because Schultz doesn't know either, where he goes with thousands and thousands of years of, like, cultural memory. That doesn't sound like someone speaking about Somalia. They think she's from Palestine.
I mean, like, it's a cucked mindset, but at least, like, Andrew Schultz is honest about it. Because a lot of people won't be honest about the fact that they're biased towards America in such a way that makes them irrational in their belief that it's, a good place, right? A lot of people are always working from the position of, like, America can't be all bad because my friends and family live here. And that is just not a political analysis. And once someone, you know, expresses that to you, you can kind of dismiss their political opinion because they're an irrational American fundamentalist. The same way that someone who is, like, in a burning house might go, well, I'm not going to abandon this house because it's my thing. You wouldn't stay in that house with them. You wouldn't, like, you know, you would understand it, I suppose. But yeah, like, that's the political opinion of a lot of Americans, where, like, they don't want to understand or understand what America is about at the geopolitical level, or how it treats marginalized populations at home, or, like, the history, because it would make them feel bad. And they don't want to feel bad about the place that they live. They don't want to feel bad about the place where them and their friends get drunk. And I mean, it's just a childish mindset. I totally get it, but it's just a childish mindset that I think that once people express, you kind of just have to dismiss them politically, because it's like, well, yeah, but you know, you want to live in a fairy tale. I will say, though, I find, like, the conceit of Club Random to be so dangerous with a guy like Bill Maher. He gets, like, so drunk and then just gets, like, so lecherous. Like,
I know. Oh, well, no, we played clips of him having, like, literal... But Binger, is your mic muted? Yep.
I think I did mute it. Whoops, my bad.
Yes, and I want you to weigh in just a second, but, like, we played clips of him having children on there and talking about porn with them.
I remember that. People are posting that now.
Let's do it, yeah.
You're interested in, like, climate change, so you start looking on that. That's a big issue. I mean, your kids are worried about it for a good reason. Okay, climate. It leads you to weather. Then you're looking up stuff about the weather. Then it leads you to Stormy Daniels. All right, now you're into porn. Now you're into a porn site. What do you do? You're interested in...
He should be arrested. Did those girls are not old enough to hear that word. Are you kidding me?
Disgusting.
Sorry.
I mean they don't, like, they probably didn't even know. I mean, they definitely didn't understand the segue. Who the fuck is Stormy Daniels to them? You know what I mean? Like, and he just says it as if they would know who the hell she is.
I didn't remember how young those girls were. Oh my God. Okay, Binder, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, the idea that someone born and raised here and never lived anywhere else knows more about having nothing else than a refugee who actually experienced how bad it was somewhere else and came here and understands the difference because they've lived that experience is ludicrous. And we know, based on just both of their socioeconomic status, that there's no one more likely to hightail it and run somewhere else where they can pay money for an extravagant sort of a bunker somewhere, like a lot of rich tech billionaires are buying up land in like New Zealand and shit. These are the people who'll be the first to run somewhere else if something went wrong.
Oh, yeah, and, no, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, I just will say, like, the whole idea that it's important that, like, because she's an immigrant, she has a separate identity, and that is in some way a threat. Do they say that about Italian-Americans? Like, I grew up in Jersey.
Well, they say it about Jewish people, so, you know, it's that kind of bigotry again.
Right. Well, I mean, Bill Maher may not say that, but I mean, that's basically, like, right, that's the anti-Semitic trope of dual loyalty, Italian-Americans, Irish-Americans. The only reason that it's a problem that she's incorporating her experience as an immigrant into her worldview is that she is Black. And that she is Muslim, and that's it, and a leftist.
Why is she the only one who has an identity other than just being an American? Both those guys have tons of different identities too. For the longest time, Bill Maher's whole thing was that he was an atheist or whatever. I'm sure the first thing that Andrew Schultz identifies with, although I'll argue with this one, is being a comedian. Yeah. These guys aren't Americans first and foremost. Give me a break.
Exactly. Reed, Marx, and Lenin says, people who equate criticism with hatred of America are such snowflakes. They need constant positive reinforcement and have no mental capacity for anything other than such. Also, has anyone checked Club Random for a gas leak? It seems like the brain functions rapidly diminish upon entering there. I'm not suggesting anyone fix the gas leak. Maybe turn it up a bit. I was just curious. What you are witnessing is people getting drunk and hell as high and high as hell because Bill Maher keeps pushing it on people. Don't make me drink alone. Who was the sober guest that he had on? He got mad at him.
Well, Steve-O was the one who wanted to come on, but said they couldn't be drinking. And I mean, I think a lot of like comedians, especially in that like podcast, like alpha male space, are easily cucked. They pretend like they're free thinkers, but Joe Rogan is the same way. Like when Bill Maher just sits there and starts acting intransigently bigoted, or like Joe Rogan starts acting intransigently like crazy, they just like clam up because they want to yes and everything. They want to go along. They have the platform. Like there's like a type of like submissiveness that these guys always take when it comes to these kinds of conversations because they don't want to be seen as the person who's like putting a damper on the fun. So, you know, it's hard to think of them as like truth seekers or trendsetters because there's always situations like this where you can tell they're uncomfortable, but they don't want to speak out. Like when, you know, Andrew Tate was saying that he didn't want to play the Kanye West song, but he was just sitting there with those guys like being like, well, I didn't like it. I didn't say anything or do anything. It's like, yeah, because, you know, at the end of the day, like you aren't like, you know, you're all about that talk, but not about that life. Right.
Right. I pray to Pesci says Bill Maher's particular brand of smug racism never fails to evoke a primal rage every time he runs his mouth. I hear ya. Velvet. Is Bill Maher an alcoholic? I'm not a doctor. But.
No. Alcoholics have a problem with alcohol. Bill Maher's solution is alcohol. So that's not like that's an alcohol enthusiast.
Exactly. Terry, can Ilhan Omar still sue Bill Maher for slandering regarding marrying her brother? It is almost impossible if you are an elected politician to sue for slander.
It's not worth it, stupid Nazi shit. I mean,
Donald Trump is saying it.
Yeah. Star Power Ultimate. It was going to be like step on my balls to reinforce my masculinity and power. Spaghetti Brains, evangelicals literally have weird little ceremonies where girls wear white dresses and do mini marriage vows with their dads to promise they'll be virgins until they get real married. Effing freaks.
Sorry about that. I'm just looking for Bill Maher talking about the Bible.
Oh. Jasmine Grockett, is Gutfeld a homeless Vietnam veteran? How has he been given the right to be this angry?
I think, like, one of the things about
the American Republic in the longer scope of world history is that if you are a citizen of a fucking country, you get to be mad about what the government's doing, you little hobbit.
Wavy gravy. Emma, not sure this has been brought up, but I remember the story you told about getting pulled on stage and being sung to. Someone found the video, and it's currently on MR Reddit. Okay, well, great. If you want to see Jason Derulo singing to me when I'm 15, you can find it on the MR Reddit. Oh. Oh.
CC Greg Gut. No.
16-year-old Emma Vigeland up on
stage. Am I 16? No, I got my braces off when I was 15.
It says around 16-year-old. So, yeah.
I still had braces at that time. I was think the last of my friends. I hated those rubber bands. Oh my god!
Oh, I feel like you gotta play it now.
No! Alright, oh my god! Yes, just put it up. What do you mean? Holy ripped jeans, blazer, and ballet flats. Oh my god!
Iconic.
For a long time.
That's crazy.
The whole song.
That's not your video, right?
See? This isn't right. Like, I'm really young here. Okay, stop it. Go to the end, maybe. When I think he asked my name. That might be at least funny. Okay, yeah. This was.
What was it like to see those moves up close?
Okay, see, what the? I can't believe I did not remember. He took me off the stool and sang to me like that. Yeah, this is inappropriate. Emma, there you go. Oh my god.
That's crazy that someone recorded that and has it up on YouTube after all those years. Well, what year is this, you said?
Can you tell me what? It must have been 2009, 2010? The video will say.
Well, this video was uploaded recently.
Oh, uploaded recently?
Oh, wait, no.
This was uploaded 16 years ago.
Okay, so
16 years ago? Oh, my God.
2010.
There you go.
35K views.
There's no whoever has that video must be very confused as to why
popping off right now.
It's popping off.
There's like so much I would love to know about being a 21-year-old girl.
Humphrey Plo Jogger, it's got to be tough to weather the parasocial impact of being a beloved figure in a lefty space, and I commend Emma for putting up with it. That said, that video is hilarious. I mean,
that's just crazy that someone in 2010 recorded it and you don't know this person. So they had no reason to record a stranger up on stage and uploaded it 16 years ago. That's crazy.
I mean, I think it was probably more about like it was probably a Jason Derulo fan, I guess, who went to the Gaga concert.
Was, yeah, they just thought like I need to post this really awful quality video.
Sleeper service. As someone who was brought into the new atheism movement, it was a very instructive realization that religion was not the root of all evil, since most of the champions of that movement ended up being unapologetic shitheads.
Yep.
I pray to Pesci. Today is a great day. Floyd the Barber. I just got secondhand embarrassment seeing it posted. Yeah. Wavy gravy. Emma, not sure if this has been brought up. Oh, wait, I just read that out loud. Okay. Hack all the things. Reminder, these kids are here because the parents were super fans and the producer pushed for these particular segments.
I mean, that's what I think of when I see that. The whole Nickelodeon stuff is parents pushing kids into awful situations. That camera's messed up. Parents pushing kids into awful situations to be exploited by capitalist entertainers.
Yeah, stage parents.
That's exactly what I thought. I thought the Nathan for You bit with the magician, like the magician's trick at the end of season one.
Yes.
Where like he's gonna expose himself and like he explains to like the show parents like what the thing is. They're like, it's totally fine.
Yeah, yeah. Right. That is actually my favorite Nathan Fielder bit, which was he performed a trick And the he said, "What's the riskiest thing? Becoming a sex offender?" And he said, "He has to get out of handcuffs before a robot pulls down his pants to expose him to a bunch of children."
Yeah,
I forgot about
and
that.
Like he explains it to the parents of the kids, and they're just like, "Yeah, that's fine."
Yeah,
what's the check like?
Ryan Edwards, Emma, I can't tell you how much you and your voice in the progressive democratic socialist discourse, thank you. I'm in Nashville, and if you've seen our news recently, women here are now in immense medical danger. Being able to turn into MR every day to hear you standing up and representing the women in this country who are scared and terrified of going anywhere near people who could help, who are supposed to help, makes it possible to keep going in this world. It gives us hope and makes us feel seen and represented and cared about. Thank you for being and existing and speaking out for us. What a very lovely I am. Thank you. It made me a little bit emotional. Majority Report Peace Prize. Ilhan Omar has been a citizen longer than Melania Trump by 6 years. There you go.
Also, people can look this up. I'm not making this up. This is the a significant number of visas that are being issued, like as in to say like 40% or some, are going to OnlyFans models.
Mm.
So the sex trafficking stuff, maybe not. It might not be over.
Sir Dunk the Tall, Emma turning red as a tomato, I'm sure. Emma Stone says the Claw episode was the best. Lots of IMs about me. Illuminati Kids, if this was a horror movie, whoever had that channel would notice the view explosion, and instead of uploading more Derulo content clips, it would be other I don't want more unrelated Emma content clips. It's just okay. We want to do 16?
Is that
Ruben?
See. Oh, yeah.
Here's Dave Ruben justifying imperialism. I am shocked that Dave Rubin, who went to Israel recently and took some photos in a bulletproof vest because of how under threat Israel is from the Palestinians that they're genociding.
They want to kill him for his ideas.
I'm just so shocked that he supports bombing Iran and is just like completely in lockstep with the Israeli government's line here. It's almost like Dave Rubin was caught taking Russian money that went away through, you know, a front of Edward Gregorian. I mean, he was really easily fooled when they offered him six-figure checks for videos. It's almost like some of that money dried up and you had reporting that Benjamin Netanyahu, some point last year, met with right-wing influencers that included Tim Pool and I believe Dave Rubin as well. And that perhaps they have some aligned incentives here. Now, I'm not saying that Dave Rubin is taking money from Israel-aligned groups, but he has a history of taking money from groups aligned with foreign governments and not asking a ton of questions about it. So here he is on his...
Also, he hates Muslims for free.
Yes. And honestly, that might be the one consistent through line of his career, seriously. Even before becoming the less liberal, he was a bit of a it was over the Sam Harris thing, actually.
Sam Harris with Cenk, yeah.
Yes, I mean, you know, obviously we've had many disagreements with Cenk recently, but that was, I remember, one of the reasons I got into TYT was Cenk was calling out the Islamophobia.
I like that debate. Yeah.
Of Sam Harris, but it was the break was why he had to leave the left was because he just couldn't stomach the idea that some corners of the left were calling out Islamophobia, even though the Democratic Party, by the way, Zionists locked in on it, all for it. So, look at how Zoran Mamdani was treated. Here's Dave Rubin, but I digress, on Iran.
Do anything in the world. The world is always put into these odd situations.
Let me go back a little bit further. This is about intervention broadly speaking.
Oh, the world is always put in these odd situations?
Yeah, it's so unfortunate the situations we end up where we have to point our guns at people.
I mean, the world's just like an episode of Candid Camera.
maybe we need Donald Trump to help us. Now, this is where America is always put into these odd situations. If we don't do anything in the world seems to go to crap. Then we do things, and sometimes it works out, and it's good, and often it doesn't work out. So I don't know what exactly we should be doing in Mexico right now. This is
Here's a start. Stop selling all the weapons to them. Do you know how many gun stores are in Mexico? Dos. You know how many are in that's two for the people who don't speak Spanish. You know how many people – that was from the Harper's index from about 4 or 5 years ago, but I think it's still true. How many gun stores are in the states bordering Mexico and America? About 9,000. So that'd be one thing, is stop selling them the guns they use to arm up. And then the other thing is stop being the demand for the drugs. Because guess what happened with when we prohibited alcohol, is it made gangs like Al Capone really fucking strong.
I mean, I was wondering where he was going, but one, the Mexican authorities say that the guns that they seized from this group, 80% were manufactured in the United States. And two, the gangs that they're talking about in Mexico, like if we were more borderless and say the United States, I don't know, this was in our territory. It's not in our territory by design, is basically what I'm saying. Our drug war disproportionately affects countries outside of the United States. So we use militarism against areas where these black markets can thrive and where the drug trade, operating, basically.
People understand this based on prohibition.
I'm struggling through that.
People understand this based on prohibition. Why is it that we got rid of, we said prohibited alcohol, and all of a sudden these gangster groups that challenge a monopoly of violence started forming? Because the profitability when you prohibit something goes up. Now, I would say you prohibit guns and you treat drug abuse like a public health crisis like it is.
Yes.
I mean, ultimately, I think the drug war is just another example of the, you know, American military-industrial complex, prison-industrial complex, like the elite of America's strategy at home and abroad, which is destabilization of any community or nation that might one day rise up to challenge the current status quo. We see the same kind of tactics used in like the drug war, as we see used in the war on terror, as seen in like the shadow wars in Africa, as seen in like the war on crime in certain communities. And it's all meant to ensure that there's like a constant state of chaos in places that allow for, you know, that chaos to be weaponized in pursuit of further eroding people's civil rights, but empowering the handful of people who are already empowered. So, I mean, I think that what Dave Rubin is identifying is part of a cycle meant to confuse and convince people like Dave Rubin into supporting more intervention, actually. It's like, oh, you know, we caused this problem behind the scenes with our policies to convince dummies like you that the only solution is for beleaguered, bumbling America to just get involved, because like otherwise, like things might just get a little dangerous for no reason.
Yes. Yes. This violence that is not always on our borders, even if we're the number one consumers of drugs, is the result of blowback of militarism towards drug policy. And then what they try to sell us is more militarism towards drug policies. And it's easier for them to sell because it's outside of American borders. But No,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's also part of a foreign policy strategy that Obama was very strong on, which is like the externalization of American borders into like South America, where you see a lot of the border actions going on in Mexico that would normally be happening at the border of America to prevent people from having like, you know, access to asylum rights, to prevent people from having like the negative publicity that would blow back onto America. And so a big part of our foreign policy in South America has been like the externalizing of American borders down as far as they can go into South America through the drug war justification, through like the migrant caravan, stuff like that. Sorry.
Exactly right. All right, keep going.
To the backdrop of, it sounds like we're about to do something in Iran. Obviously, we got Maduro out of Venezuela. Their administration is talking about Cuba. I mean, we clearly are looking at the world in a whole new way right now. But
what?
If you just think about it this way. To our north, we have Canada, which basically...
Just for folks following along at home, we've been basically strangling Cuba...
For 60 years.
Yeah, for as long as they've not been a slave society. And the only way we're looking at them now is we need to strangle harder.
And he's talking about Iran. What is new about this policy? The Daily Show did this like 30-year montage of Benjamin Netanyahu saying the same thing about Iran being so close to a nuclear weapon, so we have to do a war against them. It's quite literally the most continuous foreign policy, like neocon push that I can think of is war with Iran. It is the crown jewel. It's not new. It's actually the inverse.
Iran, obviously, we got Maduro out of Venezuela. Their administration is talking about Cuba. I mean, we clearly are looking at the world in a whole new way now.
You're so
dumb. If you just think about it this way, to our north, we have Canada, which basically has become it's not a failed state, but it is you could call it almost a satellite of China at this point, and it's largely been taken over by the Islamists and everything else, which is why...
Folks, take notes here, because I don't know, our neighbors up north, I didn't realize things had gotten so bad there. You're one failed satellite state of China. But Islamo you've also been taken. Yeah, the Islamo communist conspiracy. Because China, famously great with Muslims.
Yeah. I also like that the deal, the multi-year trade deal that was signed, I guess, by Carney or the agreement with the Chinese government to have more collaborations for electric vehicles. I mean, it just took place immediately. It has become a failed state that it's being run by the Chinese just instantly when you do one trade deal with China. I mean, that's why the United States is completely pure of Chinese influence, is that we have no economic relationship with China.
Well, those cars are Decepticons, Emma. That's the obvious track.
North, we have Canada, which basically has become it's not a failed state, but it is you could call it almost a satellite of China at this point, and it's largely been taken over by the Islamists and everything else, which is why Trump wants Greenland, right? Because you want to keep Russia away, and if Canada is useless, then Greenland is the buffer from basically Russia to us, because Canada is not going to do anything, right?
Name? Carney. Wait, when did Russia come into this? Did he confuse China and Russia?
Also, does he know where Greenland is on the map?
We need a new buffer.
Well,
if we don't have Greenland, then Russia will just go right over Greenland and right over Canada, and we'll be sitting ducks. what is there to not understand?
I mean, he is being a true Zionist and talking about seizing land to create a buffer zone.
Yeah, as you have, it is very Zionist. As you hysterically inflate the threat that you face, calling Canada a failed state a borderline failed state that is a satellite of China and also Islamist. This is lunatic stuff.
Can you just go back? Because I don't know.
Leap to Russia?
I need to know how he leapt to Russia. Because if he's... There's just... Like a lot of dumb people, he has a lot of synapses firing in his brain, and it doesn't necessarily always meet like the right spot that it's supposed to land on, because it's true that Greenland has been fought over by Russians and the United States for decades, in like the fact that it's strategically placed in the Arctic in a way that, one, with climate change, as things melt, it could create an even easier trade route. So controlling trade in that area allows you to have some shortcuts. But prior to that, it was at the center of the Cold War between the USSR and the United States, because you could basically put nukes there. So if he has that history in his mind, he's inserting it here, because we were just talking about China. Is he trying to imply that China and Russia are working together?
For Islam?
For Islam.
They both love Islam.
So. Okay, all right. I need to hear this again.
Because you know how Putin loves the Chechens.
Oh, yeah.
You just think about it this way. To our north, we have Canada, which basically has become it's not a failed state, but it is you could call it almost a satellite of China at this point, and it's largely been taken over by the Islamists and everything else, which is why Trump wants Greenland, right? Because you want to keep Russia away, and if Canada is useless, then Greenland is the buffer from basically Russia to us, because Canada is not going to do anything, right? Remember, what was it? What's his name? Carney was like, oh, well, we send some boats to patrol around Greenland. Like, that's going to scare the Russians. So that's on our northern border. And on our southern border right now, there is a president of Mexico who basically, her policy is she's not going to do anything about the cartels.
They just killed the leader of a fucking cartel.
That's the opposite.
Like, they're doing actually exactly what these folks all want, is like these decapitation strikes, which I think need to be our friends at Sober Ania podcast, Kurt Hackbarth and Jose Luis Granada's it needs to be in conjunction with broader things, like we talk about what's funneling these cartels, what was funneling Al Capone, it was fucking prohibition. Like, we, these sorts of policies, yeah, like leaning into, we need just to enforce the law, like it creates a bigger and bigger problem. Where did everyone talks about Tren de Aragua now, what's the other gang?
MS-13,
where did that start?
Prisons.
In a fucking prison.
Yeah.
This seems, as the kids say, problematic. I thought this was funny from Harrison Crank on X. While Mexico is weak, Trump should take the Baja California and rename it.
That is funny.
Hilarious.
Really, all right. Funny. Yeah, I'm over this. But that's incomprehensible. Why they're mad is that Sheinbaum is overemphasizing the fact that it was only intelligence sharing that allowed them to kill this drug kingpin, because Trump is trying to pressure her aggressively to allow U.S. military action in Mexico. And it really is genuinely a question of sovereignty and nationalism and national pride for people in Mexico. I mean, her approval ratings are through the roof because of the Morena Party's anti-poverty programs and the continuation from her predecessor AMLO. But where she has broken from him a little bit is like, so, and I think it's really just more out of necessity. I don't know. I can't speak to like what other alternatives are in Mexican politics. I'm not educated enough about it. But I do know that like if they're putting this much pressure on her, the U.S., to try to force her hand to allow for a foreign country to do military action in her country, she's left with very few options except to kind of do this herself and have a show of force. It's fascinating to see how the right is threatened by the fact that Mexico kind of flexed with nationalism and with its military prowess.
That's the thing. That's why, like, it's actually very interesting that he included Canada here and tried to paint them as a failed state as well, because it shows how ridiculous and frankly it's racist that people are more willing to entertain the idea that Mexico is a failed state, because that's the same sort of like sepia toned idea of this country that Americans have when its problems are in large part because of a neighbor that keeps giving it guns and buying, using it as an avenue to get drugs. But what happened was a cartel leader died in an enforcement action, and the cartel responded for a little bit, and the state suppressed the violent response. And I would put this also that this is against the backdrop of murders falling generally in Mexico. And that's they actually, if that happens, if Sheinbaum is taking action against the cartels and the broader violence is falling, then it shows that Sheinbaum once again is winning, and that's something these people can't have. But here's Dave just 3 months ago talking about interventions and how people are sick of them.
The only thing I would add to that, and I actually agree with some of it, but I would also say you have to ask what the American people want, right? You have to ask what the American people want. Do the American people want more of these military adventures? I'm not even talking about any specific one, and I'm not making it about Australia or anything else. But the American people, by and large, I mean, you can just look at the polling, they're not that interested in military adventures anymore. They're just simply not. We had a couple, whatever you want to call them, big mistakes or whatever it was with Iraq and some of the other things.
Crimes
and America. So the average American person, I'm not talking about what's right or wrong, or I'm not talking about principles of the past or anything else. Average American simply wants out more than before.
Oh, whoops. But then the check cleared.
And then everything's the same, and we're looking at things a little bit new. Yeah. And not like how we did with Iraq or whatever.
All right, guys, going to read some IMs and get out of here. Future reactionary, Brandon identifies as a birthday boy.
I do.
Eric from Montana, how will the CIA pay for its operations if drugs are legal?
Same way they always have, counterfeiting money.
I don't know enough about that. That's something I'll have to pick your brain on, Matt.
That's what gun running too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's another one, yeah.
What, running?
Gun running,
yeah. Joyful. Oh, my God, walking back from picking up lunch for me and my coworkers, had to stop, put everything on the ground, and watch the Emma video. Okay, great. So glad.
There's been so much traffic to Reddit.
I'm just thrilled about this development. At least it's not that close up. Chicago socialist Boebert leaks photos from closed door Hillary deposition, halting proceedings. Interesting. Todd from Raleigh, the Bohemian Grove was really interesting. Around here at UNC Chapel Hill, there's a secret fraternity of rich people's kids called the Order of Gimgul that every major politician and businessman from UNC is part of. They literally have a castle on campus, and it's heavily surveilled. One time, my friends and I approached it, and we got a blitz of calls from random numbers. Damn.
That's awesome, folks. Like, this is what we need to look into. The Order of Gimgul.
That sounds like an old one of those like text adventure games that you used to play that you used to have to like really input what you were doing in it.
Or it's just like, you know, J.K. Rowling coming up with another school, you know, or something else that she forgot to put in and is like, you know, making headlines about it.
One authoritarian opinion I have is that frats shouldn't be allowed. I don't have an opinion about sororities, but frats, no. Sorry.
Well,
guys.
I mean, I was in a sorority. I will say, you know, it's the groupthink about it is something like I experienced.
It's horrifying from the outside.
It is. And I feel very distant from that person. I was like I was the social chair. Like I was involved. And what I saw, how my male friends were treated. One of my best friends is a gay man and was treated absolutely horribly in the hazing process. Horribly. But there was no other option for like socializing because all of the parties were closed at my college. So if you wanted to go to parties that were bigger or more fun and weren't just like in a dorm, you had to be in Greek life. And the hazing stories I heard, I mean, they really abused my male friends. Yeah. Like, I mean, physical, what they had to eat, everything's really homoerotic. And there's also this culture of like not talking to the cops. And I remember one of the frats got shut down when I was in school. And I was so pissed and angry. Like, we all were like, how dare they? They got to let us do what we want or whatever. And I look back on it and it was because, like, they could have killed guys. Like, they were shut down and it was like their fifth violation. And now I look back at the, like, the guys that I was friends with even then. And I'm like, oh, I hate you. I hate you now. So it's culty and you can experience that and get really swept up in it.
and people defend are like, well, you make good connections. It's like, y'all shouldn't be running stuff. I'm sorry.
Yeah. shouldn't be. No.
You should be able to install your friends from the frat into your high paid, powerful job. It's weird to everyone.
And
else.
I told that story about that like extremely racist incident. And that was, you know, that was Greek life. Like, and you know, and it was way more segregated than anything I experienced in high school.
Right.
There was a frat at UGA, at University of Georgia, that got shut down because they were throwing antebellum parties.
Yeah.
Where they were hiring people to pick cotton. Passed.
And I was at a liberal arts Pennsylvania college. Like, what they, in the South?
Right. Yeah.
In the South, what Greek life is like is nuts. Nuts. All right, I'm gonna read some items. I'm stop talking about this. Rory in Minnesota, the amount of sexual assaults that frats commit is insane. Yep. Joe from New Jersey went to a school for 2 years in South Jersey that was only frat run. I never joined because there was so much drink spiking that girls got used to it. At certain fraternities, they thought it was just normal. I mean, yes. Certain fraternities, literally, we would have a group text and it would say, bring your own alcohol and don't drink the punch because they were putting stuff in it. Maybe not roofies, but they were putting Xanax in it. I mean, and they were putting NyQuil and stuff like that, which is really fucking crazy to think about. Yeah.
I've always wondered, like, oh, where do men learn how to, like, I don't know, buy date rape drugs? And it's like, oh, that's where.
Yeah. All right. Five more. Darth Moose, I am convinced that Dave Rubin's YouTube views are almost entirely bots. There's no way that a thinking human, even one recently kicked by a mule, could take anything he says seriously. Also, can we at least get some of those high-speed rails up here in our satellite state? Yeah. Granite counter tabletop issues says, solved. honestly, it would be for Newsom marble countertop, not granite. He's doing marble, that West Coast elitist, but good IM name regardless. Solid for you. Putin is clearly the occulted imam. Occluded. I don't know that word. What's occluded?
I think that's like
it means to block out the light from.
Oh, yeah.
You see it a lot
like
in
Oculus?
Like,
no,
not really. No. Although I think it's both to do with eyes, so maybe kind
okay.
of. But occluded is something you hear. I mean, you might have heard it in Game of Thrones.
Maybe. Noah from Tampa, the Christmas Adventurers Club. Yes.
While you're buying David Griscom's book, my buddy Devin Thomas O'Shea also has a book here called about secret societies that people might want to check out. This is about the one that, what's her name, the comedian who turns out she was in this Veiled Prophet. The girl from not Maisel, a different comedy. But anyway, The Veiled Prophet, Secret Societies, White Supremacy, and the Struggle for St. Louis, Devin Thomas O'Shea. People can either pre-order that or gift their wish list it.
Cool. Scary Mountain Wizard, the right always talks in vagueness and everything else, or people are saying, or everyone knows, they are generalizations that make it appear as if the lies are just taken as fact. The language drives me crazy. That's absolutely true. Everyone knows is a really, really common one. And you hear that from Tucker to Fox News and everywhere in between. Although Tucker came out of Fox News. And the final IM of the day. Tom Cotton's beard. The rapey behavior frats encourage is terrible. I had a roommate who was in the frat, and I didn't get why some girls were so standoffish to me once they found out we lived together. He got kicked out for sexually assaulting multiple girls.
Jesus.
Yep. All right, actually one more just because that was kind of depressing. Joe from New Jersey, question for Matt. Are there any foundational leftist books you recommend? I just finished Manufacturing Consent prior to the news about Chomsky.
It depends what you're looking for. I like Eric Hobsbawm's history series.
People's History of the U.S. by Howard Zinn, at least for me.
That's a good book. But The Age of series by Hobsbawm. Bhaskar Sankara's book for recent take on socialism, I think, is really good. Yeah.
Foundational for me, I would say, yeah, Manufacturing Consent, The Shock Doctrine, obviously. And... I still don't think The New Jim Crow gets talked about enough by Michelle Alexander. It was a really big commercial success at the time, but that was something that like completely changed my worldview when I read that in high school, I think, or college, I forget. But I think high school, so I don't know. I mean, maybe that's not leftist, but that was a foundational book for me. Yeah.
I would also, you know, it's fun too. Not fun, but Nickel and Dimed by Barbara Ehrenreich is pretty good well.
All right. Well, I guess that's that. Binder, Brandon, Matt, and Brian, thank you guys so, so much. We will see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. See the truth in the light bulb. The finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.